republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you all very much. Before we start, we have a little IT. Where's our mic? Come on up here and explain to the board. Some of the changes here are the IT, so we all know what we're doing.
Good morning, everybody. As you see, we're on the off-site today. Everything is contained in the folder March CTB. So if you click the documents and get out of them, that's where you would go back to. It's on your desktop. Also, there may be like a 3 to 5 second delay when you hit the hyperlinks, but you do not have to click left mouse click to make it happen. You can just do the left mouse click and everything should open up. Okay?
Everybody got it?
Everybody got it?
Okay, if you got problems, raise your hand.
Clear as mud.
Right over there.
And if you have any problems, just let me know and I'll be right over to assist you.
We're very pleased this morning to have with us Delegate Scott Jarrett. Hey, Scott, would you just like to say a few words? I appreciate you coming out and Senator Newman last night, too.
Well, good morning, Mr. Secretary, members of the board, and Carol, who really gets all the work done, as I understand. And I see some nods of affirmation from court. Welcome to Lynchburg. Welcome to Central Virginia. Make sure you spend plenty of money here. I want to tell you very quickly, I'm a surgeon, and in fact, I'm a trauma surgeon, and I deal with a lot of blood. And you are dealing with the lifeblood of our Commonwealth. What you do is what gets meaningful material to our communities and meaningful services to our communities and I thank you for that. We have got to get better buy-in statewide, and I think that's the value and the utility of having men and women from across our Commonwealth representing your various interests in your various areas. So stay true to that. And we will survive as a Commonwealth as we work through some of these issues. So I know you get a lot of heat. I know you get a lot of communications. And I humbly and sincerely appreciate your service to the Commonwealth of Virginia. So, Mr. Secretary, thank you for coming to Lynchburg.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate you being here. We'll get right to the agenda. The first is the Central Virginia Metropolitan Planning Organization. We have Gary Christie, the Executive Director, and Bob White.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary, members of the board. Thank you for coming to our community. I'd like to start out by introducing Mr. Kimball Payne, a member of our MPO, and Lynchburg City Manager, to give you a few words.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary. Welcome back to Lynchburg. It's good to have you here. And Commissioner Worley and Thelma Drake, we're glad to see you. We have a great partnership with VDOT, and we appreciate that. I know you had a tour yesterday and saw some of our projects that are underway, and we appreciate the support for that. So on behalf of the City Council and the Mayor, I just wanted to welcome you to Lynchburg. We're glad to have you back. And anything we can do for you, let us know.
Thank you. We appreciate all your hospitality.
Thank you. To get started, we serve four counties and two cities in Lynchburg, and you'll learn about the MPO area shortly. We are a growing region. We've had good success with our population, and the MPO is the economic hub of the region, as where the greatest population density with high-tech employment, with nuclear employment, and higher education employment anchoring our communities. Let me turn the meat of the presentation over to Deputy Director Bob White, who manages the MPO and our transportation program. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary, and thank you, Mr. Secretary and board members, for the opportunity to talk with you today. The CVMPO consists of the City of Lynchburg and the urbanizing areas of Campbell County, Amherst County, and Bedford County, including the town of Amherst. It's comprised of approximately 354 square miles of the 2,000 square miles of our region. The MPO planning area holds approximately 153,000 of our region's 242,000 residents. And our board consists of 11 members. Typically, the chief elected official of each jurisdiction, as well as the chief administrative officer of each jurisdiction, and Robert Garcia, our district administrator. A primary task of our MPO is the maintenance and update of our long-range transportation plan. We've completed the most recent update to this document in October of 2010, and we'll begin our next update this coming year. I wanted to highlight some of the key issues. Let's see if I can advance this here. Oops. I wanted to highlight some of the key issues from our last update and some related efforts because I believe they reflect the important challenges facing our community for the foreseeable future. Funding ultimately drives most of the discussions relating to transportation, and so it does with our community. This past planning cycle, we identified $96 million for project work and set through 2035, our horizon year. This is a $50 million reduction from the previous planning update. This revenue only addressed projects in the six-year improvement program, and this is in contrast to the $1.6 billion that we have identified for the same time frame for maintenance. This is typical of what the entire Commonwealth is experiencing. It's nothing new to your ears. Hopefully, with the new transportation bill in place, we'll have a better opportunity to advance our transportation system within Region 2000 and within the Commonwealth as a whole. This graphic illustrates the projects identified within both our constrained and vision plans. I show this not to describe each project, but to highlight the fact that only one project shown is new construction, and this is the U.S. 29 Bypass Extension, which is a vision project, and it's located in the lower right-hand corner of this graphic. All of the other projects, including all the projects we actually expect to have funding for, with one exception, are targeted to maintaining and extending the life cycle of our region's transportation system. At this point in time, we have to come to realize that the transportation system currently serving our region internally is what we will be looking at for the foreseeable future. That one exception is the new Oddfellows Road interchange at Route 460, which I'll speak to in a minute. As we move forward as a region, our key transportation challenges focus on three areas. And that is, the first is extending the life cycle of our current system, interregional connectivity with other areas of our country, and the world, actually, and the growth of Liberty University. To this end, a significant amount of the effort that the MPO has put forward in recent years has been directed to strengthening the connection between transportation and land use planning. Working with our localities and the district staff, we've been able to examine all our key corridors with a particular emphasis on access management. These efforts have all been considered within the locality's comprehensive planning practices, and additionally, we've been able to we've been active with the City of Lynchburg in examining key corridors within the city with a particular emphasis on promoting multimodalism, employing access management techniques to a greater extent, and taking advantage of the Safe Routes to Schools program. This is all being done to strengthen the transportation and planning connection and extend the investment and life cycle of the existing system. The second critical transportation challenge our region is facing is maintaining and strengthening interregional connectivity. This is the key economic development issue highlighted during our last plan update, but it was also raised as part of our efforts to develop the region's comprehensive economic development strategy. And this concern was again emphasized as part of our evaluation of our regional economic development efforts. This slide identifies a couple of the comments which were fairly typical as we went through these various processes. It really points to the fact that any and all efforts to maintain the throughput of our interregional highway system, including Route 29 and 460, is greatly appreciated. Liberty University continues to be an important economic driver for our community. With an on-campus enrollment of 12,500 students and almost 7,000 employees and ongoing growth forecasted, its $342 million economic impact in fiscal year 2012 will only increase as it looks to expand in areas such as a $40 million health and medical center and its 40,000 square foot aviation program facility. But with this growth comes new transportation challenges, and we're attempting to address these, but constant attention will be needed. I've mentioned the key transportation challenges, but I also wanted to take a minute and talk about alternative transportation. Over the last few years, we've made important inroads in promoting bicycling, walking, transit, and commuting activities within Region 2000. We're partnering with our area cyclists and VDOT to bring Share the Road signage to designated loops within Region 2000, as well as introducing bike lanes within our community. We are organizing an annual bike week to promote cycling as an alternative transportation choice, and we've been developing and maintaining databases such as a sidewalk inventory used to support such activities as the successful Safe Routes to Schools program in partnership with the Lynchburg School System. We're also partnering this year with the New River Valley and Roanoke Valley Allegheny regions to bring commuter service to Region 2000. This is a first for our community, and we're excited about the future of this program. Public transit, as provided by the Greater Lynchburg Transit Company, continues to provide an important element to the overall transportation solution for our region. GLTC's 40-bus fleet transports nearly 3 million passengers per year, and 2 million of these passengers are college students, mostly Liberty University, but also some from Lynchburg College and our other schools. GLTC's 12-bus paratransit fleet transports over 25,000 disabled folks annually, and we're seeing typically a 20% increase per year in that ridership. GLTC's college partnerships have encouraged a modal shift from a single-occupant vehicle to bus transport, alleviating serious congestion problems on the campus of Liberty University and its immediate area. We particularly appreciate the board's support of the new transit center at Kemper Street, currently under construction, and we hope to have that complete by the spring of 2014. This center complements the adjoining Kemper Street station, which is a current terminus for the successful regional passenger rail trains service, serving Lynchburg and points north to Washington and beyond. Securing passenger rail funding for ongoing development is a wise investment of precious transportation dollars, and we'd hope we'd be able to continue finding ways to do that. I would like to take a moment and mention three key projects that are ongoing within our region. Greenview Drive is an important connector between Wards Road and Timberlake Road. With the growth of Liberty University, this corridor is experiencing continuing traffic increases. A portion of the project has been constructed, but an additional $10.5 million is needed to improve the entire corridor. The Oddfellows Road interchange is the major new construction effort within Region 2000. And this interchange will help support the growth of Liberty University, but also provides important industrial access to the city as a whole. Not funded at this time are improvements to the Oddfellows Road connector. This road segment connects the interchange of the interchange to the Lynchburg Expressway. Without the improvements, we'll have a serious traffic bottleneck, negating a substantial amount of the investment that's been put forward for the interchange. A $10.8 million estimate is put forward, or we're expecting it'll take about $10.8 million to complete the improvements to the Oddfellows Road system. And finally, I'd ask that you would continue support for the safety and access management improvements along the 460-29 corridor. This is the major economic artery through Region 2000, and an additional $4.5 million is needed for this effort. Before I pause, I also mentioned that we'd ask for your support for an enhancement project for the restoration and reuse of the Amherst train station in Amherst County. But I will pause at this point, and if you have any questions or comments, I'd be more than happy to take those, and I'm sure Kim and Gary would also be willing to do that. Are there any questions?
Thank you for the report. It's pretty exciting to drive around the area and see all that's going on, and so we appreciate you being here and sharing that with us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob. I'm sorry, could you just come back about the projects and the status? So right now,
on the Greenview Drive? We've only put $1 million on it.
Actually, the $1 million is for the second phase. The first phase, and Kim, you may have a better feel for that number, but the first phase of Greenview Drive has already been constructed.
We've designed the second phase, and we're in the process of acquiring the right-of-way for that. We've actually got a revenue-sharing grant application in for the right-of-way purchase, and once we do that, we're hopeful that without any new money coming, that there might be the possibility of using some bonus funds one day once we get the right-of-way acquired, but it is fully designed, second phase.
Okay. And then, I'm sorry, then the Oddfellows, where are we? I thought we're doing the design.
We're in the design on the interchange. The concern now is about the connector from the expressway along Oddfellows Road through the intersection of Mayflower Drive.
And I'm sorry, so I just want to make sure I understand. And then it's when it says $10.8 million needed, funded?
The interchange is funded. Yes. It's $31 million. What we'll need for the what I call the connector, the improvements of Oddfellows Road from the interchange back to the expressway, the estimate right now is approximately $11 million to make those improvements.
Okay. Same thing with the $4.5 million, $4.6
million. To continue making the improvements along that corridor, additional funding was needed.
Well, I have to say this. It's a pleasure coming out here. When we go to Northern Virginia Hampton Roads, they're in the billions.
So this will be easy to do.
Get a lot more bang for your buck here.
We're not done asking. Yeah. Not done asking. Oh, and on Greenview Drive, $10.5 million will complete the project. Is that?
That's yes.
How, if you were to get that money, how soon would you be able to begin construction?
Well, as soon as we get the right-of-way acquired, it's ready to go. It's fully designed.
And that's what's the right-of-way look like?
I really don't know because we don't have the money for the right-of-way right now, and that's part of our revenue-sharing application.
Okay.
So I would think 6 months to a year at the most.
And then could begin.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Excellent. Appreciate it very much. Great report.
Great story.
Okay. We have the Danville MPO.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary and members of the board. Thank you for having me today. My name is Aaron Burdick. I'm the Executive Director of the West Piedmont Planning District Commission and the Administrator for the Danville MPO. The Danville MPO consists of the city of Danville and the urbanized area of Pennsylvania County. You'll see on the map in front of you the limits of the study area as well as the city and the areas of the urbanized portion of Pennsylvania County. The Danville MPO was designated by the governor in 1983 and approved by Federal Highway Administration for the West Piedmont Planning District Commission to administer the MPO. And again, that serves the city of Danville and the urbanized area of Pennsylvania County. Our board consists of the city manager for Danville, two city council members, the county administrator for Pennsylvania County, two county board of supervisor members, and the district administrator from the Lynchburg district. And then we also have alternative members from city and county staff as well as the Lynchburg district planning manager. The 2010 census urbanized area and cluster report released in March of 2012 stated that the Danville MPO had fallen below the 50,000 population threshold to be considered an urbanized area. Actually stated that we were about 600 people short, and there were some questions as to what would happen with the MPO. We were one of three areas in the country, including Galveston, Texas, and Sandusky, Ohio, for that to happen. The questions raised were what would happen with the MPO, and if so, if we'd be allowed to continue, what funding levels would be there to meet our minimum obligations. Last year, we did not receive, or fiscal year 13, did not receive PL funds, but we did receive one-time state planning resource funds. In May and June of 2012, there was a determination that was made that the MPO would be allowed to continue and that beginning in fiscal year 14, we would receive both PL and 5303 funding. In the fall of 2012, you're aware that VDOT and the Metropolitan Planning Organizations and DRPT began to review the funding formulas for those programs, and it was a series of dialogue going back and forth, and the final formula did allow for funding of the MPO with a base, which all the MPOs in Virginia received, plus it allowed the urban cluster population to bring up our funding levels. We did receive less funding than we had in the past, but it was not so much that we weren't allowed to fall below what we needed to do to meet those minimum obligations. We were down on the PL about $14,000 and about $761 on our 5303. The other thing that occurred as a result of the population loss was that Danville Transit fell below the small urban system and was now designated as a rural transit provider, and actually is the largest rural transit provider in the state. And I appreciate all the work that DRPT and VDOT did along with Federal Highways and FTA in working with us. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about our priorities. You've seen this slide before. I presented it to you in Winchester, and it relates to the Route 863 corridor coming out of North Carolina for about 7.5 miles. And this was a project that we had in mind for several years, and it actually, your decision, which we greatly appreciate, was to redesignate this or reclassify this from a secondary highway to a primary. And the reason we really thought that this was important is because it highlights the accessibility to the Berry Hill Mega Park. Additionally, we identified priorities as the designation of Route 29 and 58 bypass as Route Interstate 785 coming out of North Carolina, again, due to the economic development potential that this presents. Additionally, the connector between Route 58 West and Route 29. And then we have a safety project along Route 29 and Route 58 at the Elizabeth Street interchange. This is the only at-grade interchange along Route 29. And we've put this in front of VDOT for a number of years, but haven't been able to really make any progress on that at this time. Our major transportation planning activities right now relate to the 2035 long-range plan and how we need to modify that to address the requirements of MAP 21. The current plan forecasts $68 million in future roadway improvements, and we will begin updating the plan to the horizon year of 2040 in both fiscal years 14 and 15. We do not do a lot of in-house planning studies. We typically consult those out, and those studies are very important in that they provide our localities with the support for the continuing ongoing developments of the projects that are identified in the long-range plan. And I'll go into some detail here in a few minutes about the projects that we're currently undertaking, those projects which were completed in fiscal year 12. Additionally, we do work in support of VDOT and DRPT for the VTrans and multimodal planning support. And we're working, again, on responses to MAP 21 requirements for both VDOT and DRPT. And then we provide technical assistance to VDOT and our member localities of Danville and Pennsylvania County. One of the consultant-led studies that was conducted last year was by URS Corporation, and it looked at Route 863, which is Moorefield Bridge Road. And again, this is a portion of the route that we talked about just below being upgraded. And we looked at two alternatives to alleviate traffic on the existing route of Moorefield Bridge Road. And we thought this was important, again, because of the future development of the Berry Hill Mega Park. But we looked at it between Mount Cross Road, which is Route 750 in the city of Danville, in the interchange of U.S. Route 58 West in Pennsylvania County to this Pennsylvania County. We decided that after looking at the alternatives that the existing alignment was our best way to move forward. Both of the alternatives had funding amounts put to them at about $25 million, and there wasn't any feasibility in doing that. They were too cost prohibitive, and the benefit was not commensurate with those costs. The trip generation, even with adding the Berry Hill Mega Park future forecast, just did not make that feasible. As a result of the no-build alternative, in the current fiscal year, we have a project looking at the geometric alignments along Moorefield Bridge Road, and I'll discuss that in just a moment. All of our studies in fiscal year 12 were conducted by URS Corporation. The second was an access management study and plan along Route 58 West, looking at the corridor's capacity and safety, and looking at different access management measurements. And this was designed primarily to guide future development and provide interested property owners in what expectations there were for access along the corridor. The third study was the Mount Crossroad Improvement Study, and this is a project that actually has just been awarded the engineering portion, but there's about $6 million in construction dollars that have been allocated to this. The study was to look at the optimal method for improving the existing two-lane facility, and what the ultimate alternative that was preferred called for was the widening of Mount Crossroad within Danville and an upgrade to the roadway within Pennsylvania County. This was in part selected because it provides the greatest extent of improvements within the budget of the six-year plan and addressed all the deficiencies and future forecasts. The final was a trail connector study, and this was one that had been in the works for several years and is part of the Beaches to Bluegrass Trail once constructed. And the goal of this was to find the optimal corridor for a shared-use path for bicyclists, pedestrians, and other non-motorized trail users, including equestrian facilities. And this is a very neat project, and we were very happy that we were able to get the Industrial Development Authority to allow us to utilize some of our industrial parks to construct the future corridor. That's not something that we've done in this region, but it's been very beneficial in other parts of the state, especially for attracting new businesses to those parks. During fiscal year 13, we have two studies currently ongoing, and our first input session is actually this afternoon for both of them. The first is Kentuck Road, which is being conducted by Dewberry, and it looks at the existing alignment from Route 58 in the city of Danville near the airport, moving north to the intersection of Little Creek Road, which is in Pennsylvania County, just over the county line. There are some industrial properties here, and there's some high-level crashes that we're looking at, and essentially just looking at what we can do within the existing corridor to alleviate some of those traffic congestion and crash data recommendations. The second, again, as I mentioned earlier, is the existing alignment study along Moorfield Bridge Road. Again, this is being conducted by Dewberry, but we're looking at geometric improvements and spot improvements, specifically in the crossing of Sandy River. This intersection, this project also looks at the intersections of Mount Crossroad and Westover Drive, and looks at whether or not we need to put in additional turn lanes and or signalization. Our transit planning activities are essentially those in support of the Danville transit system. As I mentioned earlier, they are now the largest rural transit provider in the state, and they are going to be looking at their travel demand plans in the next couple years, but 80% of our 5303 funds are passed through to Danville Transit to support the transit manager and some of his staff, and the PDC support is essentially that for the current and long-range planning studies, as well as developing the Unified Work Program and helping them to meet all of their grant requirements, including Title VI, DBE, and Equal Opportunity Employment. With that, I'd like to conclude my presentation and thank the board and VDOT and DRPT, as well as Federal Highways and Federal Transit, for the partnerships that we've established. And we think that these have been very beneficial in helping us to have several transportation-related needs addressed.
Yes, Mr. Peek.
Yes, Aaron, thank you for that presentation. I'll tell you, you weren't here yesterday, but the board saw a slideshow of various projects in the area, including the Robertson Bridge.
Yes, sir.
And so they gave us a good view of the Robertson Bridge, and I think everybody was impressed with how quickly that project
yes,
was done and how it helped the area. Mr. Garzinski, I believe, remembered traveling all down to Greensboro through that
That's
bridge,
right.
So it brought back some good memories.
In the old days.
The real
several years ago.
That was a fantastic project that has significantly helped the traffic circulation in the city.
You don't really request any funds or indicate any projects. Are there any projects that are waiting design on your plan to be built, or it looks like you need a lot of money for consulting and planning and engineering? How would you characterize your situation?
This right now, the biggest thing that we have concerns with, the city of Danville is looking at losing about $240,000 through the change in the functional classification system as a result of Map 21 and the need to review those. But as far as specific projects in the city and county, for many years we thought it was the alternative alignment to the Moorefield Bridge, which had that $25 million price tag with it. Study showed it wasn't necessary. So now we've been looking more at an access road to the Berry Hill Mega Park that is currently in design work, but we're trying to figure out if we continue to use a consultant or if it is going to be moved over to a VDOT locally administered program, and I'm not sure of the status of that at this time, but that is the major project that we have in the works right now, and that's currently being held up by right-of-way acquisition.
Do you have any idea the type of money you would need to conduct that study?
I do not.
Mr. Miller? Mr. Burdick, thank you for your presentation. I was looking at and was intrigued by slide 11 of 19, which is the Route 863 study, and it's...
The fiscal year 12 or 13.
The 12, and I would tell you that I won't call it refreshing because we've seen it before, but it's nice to see somebody do a study and say we don't need to build this road. I mean, we're obviously in a situation where we don't have all the money that we would like to have to do what we need to do across the Commonwealth, but it's darn good to see somebody say, it's nice to have, but not needed.
Well, thank you.
So
it was.
I salute you. It's something in the water here in this part of the country where people just don't spend money to spend money, so I love seeing that. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you. For a $50,000 planning level study, it saved us quite a bit of money by not having to explore that any further.
Mr. Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Burdick, thanks. Good job. My question was along the same line, or I thought was along the same lines as Mr. Miller's. It's encouraging to see. We see that cost-benefit analysis give us the answer that the no-bill alternative is the best, but we normally see that in billion-dollar projects, not in $20 or $25 million projects. So I applaud you, and it's encouraging. What were the factors that drove you to do the study in the first place?
The thought process was that the increase in traffic generated by the Berry Hill Mega Park would necessitate the existing alignment to be overutilized. So we're just looking for an alignment from 58 to get to Mount Crossroad that would, again, alleviate the traffic on the existing corridor and eventually get you up to Route 29 in an easier way, saving folks time.
Thank you.
Any other questions? May I ask you about, you didn't really discuss this. You have as your priority designation of the bypass as a interstate. Could you explain that?
For several years now, the city and county have been talking about the need to open that bypass to additional traffic, and the thought process is that having it designated as an interstate makes it more attractive.
But it's just simply designating it as such without doing any other work?
I think the long-term process is to bring it up to interstate standards, because currently it is not.
Where would it start? Where would it end? It's just the bypass?
It would just be the bypass, yes, sir.
Any other questions?
No, I'm not sure if it's included in that.
Yes, thank you very much.
It is within our planning district, but outside of the Metropolitan Planning Organization. So we do rural transportation planning for the city of Martinsville through the West Piedmont Planning District.
They had a project where they were hoping to lead to the speedway and develop an economic park over there. Do you know if that is taking fruition at all?
I believe that project is being stalled at this time from the environmental standpoint.
It hadn't started at all. They're still trying to.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Sir.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Burton.
Thank you.
Next is the Bristol Metropolitan Planning Organization. We have Rex Montgomery.
Yes. can see if I can open it.
Thank you. My wife says I'm always a little too hard on those things. I'm Rex Montgomery, and it's good to be before the board again. I'm with the Bristol MPO, and of course, we are a bi-state MPO. In fact, the state line runs right down the middle of State Street. As far as our member jurisdictions, of course, the two Bristols, Tennessee and Virginia, and a portion of Washington County, Virginia, and Sullivan County. The current population of the planning area is about 90,000. We do have, this graphic right here represents our planning boundary, which is based on our 2,000 urbanized area, and I'll come back to that in a minute. We do have three-quarters of statewide significance, Interstate 81, Route 11, and Route 58. We have the Norfolk Southern Railroad, and it will accommodate double-stack container freight. We have two small urban transit systems and a rural transit system. We are currently attainment for air quality, and our next long-range plan is due in 2015. The urbanized area, ours, we became an MPO in the 1980 census when we reached 50,000 population. The UZA, for those that aren't aware of it, is what the MPO establishes their planning boundary on. It's also what many state and federal funding allocations are based on. From the 2000 census to the 2010 census, our population grew approximately 19%. This is our urbanized area based on the 2000 census. Approximately 70% of the population is in Tennessee and 30% is in Virginia. With the 2010 census, two significant things happened. First was Abingdon, Virginia came into our urbanized area, and Bluff City, Tennessee was designated part of the Johnson City urbanized area. So now our population is approximately 52% Tennessee and 48% Virginia. If you look at this overlay, you can see that our urbanized area is slowly shifting north, and we predict that by the next census, most of the population will be in Virginia. Oops. We are coordinating with our local and state officials right now to adjust our MPO boundary. We have to include, at a minimum, the entire urbanized area. And of course, this will be, we'll have to have revisions to our MPO voting membership and our bylaws and our planning documents. We plan on coordinating all of this with our next long-range plan update. We do have some projects in the current six-year plan. Our focus, as is was last year, is the Route 11 corridor. We have a project going on at Exit 7 for reconstruction there. That is a fully funded project. We have four segments of Route 11 that's currently in the PE phase or funded for the PE phase only. This is a major initiative for the MPO and the city. It's economic development driven. And we have some funding for signalization projects through the Highway Safety Improvement Program. And the reason I bring this up is these are relatively small projects, but for a small urbanized area to make a big impact, not only on safety, but the streetscape. This is another signalization project, relatively small, but it includes a relocation of an intersection. Bristol Virginia Transit was just able to purchase some new rolling stock. I think they got three new buses. And again, that's a small project, but it makes a big impact to the transit ridership. We've had several enhancement projects. One was to restore the historic train station. That was an interesting project because the matching funds were provided by a nonprofit organization. And we've used some enhancement funds to decorate the streetscape with a decorative lighting. Our priorities continue to be the Route 11. We have several segments there that are missing a project. Of course, we'd like to see full funding for the whole corridor between Bristol and Abingdon. And this continues to be an area of high development. And of course, public transportation, we're looking at extending some routes, and of course, that comes along higher operating costs and capital costs. And pedestrian bike facilities, we have a lot of sidewalk renovations that's being done by local government, but we also appreciate VDOT including bicycle and pedestrian facilities in their projects. And I know these are needs like all communities have in Virginia, but I think it's just a matter of scale. And with that, I'll entertain any questions.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Montgomery, being from Northern Virginia, we're the other MPO that shares with another state and District of Columbia. I was just curious as to how you're able to address the two competing states' visions and how that works for you.
Right now, it's a very interesting question. It's a challenge because a lot of the programs are they're organized differently. Of course, we'd have to deal with two different fiscal years, which is confusing. We're on alternating years for the development of the STIP. So that makes it a challenge. But as far as dealing with the state DOTs, we've not had any problem with dealing with our federal programs as far as long-range planning, any initiatives like that.
Thank you.
Yes,
Mr. Ross. That's our reason for believing that the majority of the population will be Virginia versus Tennessee in a few years.
In 10 years? Based on the urbanized area definition that's delineated by the census.
Yeah, and the reason your growth is just simply that now you include Abingdon. Is that right?
Correct.
A very urbanized area.
Yeah. Yeah. Question for you. We had the opportunity to see and visit Bristol last year.
Mm-hmm.
And saw your railroad enhancement station. That was very, very charming. The question I have, though, as the population shifts, do you have any resistance from our Tennessee brethren to placing that emphasis or priority on Route 11? Do you see that as a problem? Or because you're saying that's the number one priority,
mm-hmm.
is between Abingdon and Bristol, the improvement of 11.
No, I don't see that as any problem. In fact, Abingdon is willing to be on board with this, and we've already started working with Abingdon for their membership in the MPO.
But you don't have any on the Tennessee side saying, well, that's only a Virginia project and that's not benefiting us at all?
No, we've never had that situation.
It is Route 11. That's mm-hmm. that's the number. If you had your wish and you were king for the day, that's what the MPO would favor.
That would be it.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Montgomery, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now I'll hear from the Kingsport Metropolitan Planning Organization, Bill Albright.
Which one is it? Okay. Thank you. Bill Albright, Kingsport, Tennessee/Virginia MPO. I'm on sort of a fish out of water. Haven't been here before in a different state. I deal in Tennessee primarily. In fact, you're talking about population percentage, even greater amount in Tennessee than in Bristol, and you'll see the map here in just a moment. This is a map of our study area, which you can see just a small portion northern area there is in Virginia, and that includes Weber City and Gate City, parts of Scott County. So I'm representing Scott County here today. Again, this is just a better shot of the MPO study area in Scott County. We don't have that many projects, but we do have some important issues. We'll get to those here in just a second. I put this together a few days ago sort of hurriedly. Wasn't sure I was going to be here, but some of the problems Scott County has right now is accessibility. We're like some of you guys around here. We have a lot of mountains, a lot of ridges, and topography just limits the routing, the old routes, and the new routes of highways. And because of that, it creates travel time problems, emergency services, which is a big deal. Anything in, north of Moccasin Gap, and we'll get to that here in just a minute, it's a scary situation because the only route to Kingsport, which is where primary medical services are, is through that gap. If you have a derailment or a major accident, you're in big trouble if you live north of Moccasin Gap. It's always been that way. I mean, the nearest westward gap is Cumberland Gap, and eastward, I think, is towards Lebanon. So if that, something happens in Moccasin Gap, you're cut off. It's a serious situation for emergency services. Of course, congestion on US 23 I think there's around 25,000 cars a day that go through there. It's one of these old-fashioned four lanes that I guess you'd call it the city boulevard years ago, that is just full of curb cuts. That, in fact, sometimes it's such a beehive, it's almost a nightmare to get through. And it's a major highway from Kentucky and Ohio all the way to South Carolina into I-26 and Jacksonville. I think I've got a map here in a minute. So access management is important. Safety, of course, is always important. Sight distance and clear zones. I drove around. I've done it many times, but last week I drove around to see how many sight distance problems. And I know this may be a maintenance issue, but sight distance and clear zones, that is a nightmare as well. You cannot make mistakes on the roads in Scott County. You make one little mistake, your tire drops off, you're in trouble. That's very important, I think, from your safety people to look at. In Scott County. Of course, I mentioned accessibility to the airport and the interstate is also difficult. I'm going to throw in opportunities. I'm not sure this is a slide that should be in here. Your tax structure is different. You can see what's happening in Bristol, Virginia right now with the economic growth at Exit 7 and on out because of the tax structure. You have 350,000 people in Tennessee that have access to Exit 7, and it's fueling the growth there. You have the same situation in Weber City and Gate City that they're not really taking advantage of. And why does that have anything to do with transportation? Well, it creates trips. And if somebody ever wakes up in Weber City, they're going to make a huge impact on the economy in this area and create a lot more trips that need to be dealt with. Again, it's access to a large market that I think hasn't been taken advantage of for many decades. And there's a lot of developable property in that area of Weber City, believe it or not, there really is. The through traffic, US 23 to I-26, again, this map may not show it too well, but you can see it goes from Detroit, Michigan to Jacksonville, Florida, through Weber City and Gate City. It is a funnel. It truly is of traffic in that area. So, it's an opportunity to capture some of that tourism and travel. It also creates a problem. Going to current projects, Yuma Road Phase 2, that is, I think, $5 or $6 million in improving the western end of Yuma Road, and that is badly needed. Again, there's a couple of major collectors in Scott County that need to be addressed. This is one of them, and you're doing a good job on that, so I appreciate that very much. And this just shows a difference between on the left side of your screen of what the old road looks like now as opposed to some improvements that were made years ago in Phase 1 on the right-hand side, just what you can do there. By the way, this is a map that shows Yuma Road east-west. The location. Also, Moccasin Gap Phase 2. I'm not sure this is really active. You did Phase 1 here a while back that changed the intersection there, 58 to 224, which we call Wadlow Gap Road. That is phase one. That did not correct the problem. I'm sorry, it rearranged a little bit of things, but it didn't correct the problem. There's a phase two that needs to be pursued, and one of the ideas is to do a roundabout. That's pretty radical, but I think that in some cases it may work. In this area, it might. We put several roundabouts in Kingsport, and they have worked extremely well. I know that the Federal Highway has done studies, and roundabouts reduce critical accidents by 70% and reduce almost all accidents by 40%. That's something to consider in your urban areas.
Are there two-lane highways, or are the two lanes each direction?
The U.S. 23 is four lanes. 58 to 421 is two lanes.
And a roundabout would work there.
Well, I'm not sure. That is being proposed, right, Donnie?
It has been studied and will work.
Okay. Again, U.S. 23 from State Line to Gate City is a traffic nightmare. It's a sign clutter nightmare. It's a sight distance nightmare, and you need some access management. Frontage roads, backage roads, that's a new term, I guess, or maybe been around. But you've got some opportunities to build some backage roads. They're sort of there now. It needs to be formalized and improved to get some of the, hop, skip, and jump type traffic off of 23. People come out of one gas station, go, 300 feet to a church or to another location, and that's where your access management can make a big difference. And you've got so many curb cuts here, it's unbelievable. And that, there's some signal timing as well that might help, some coordination there, particularly towards Moxon Gap. Phase three of Moxon Gap, and this is where it gets pretty extreme. I went to the district office, 15 years ago to spend a week looking at Moxon Gap project and came up with a fairly elaborate plan to rework that entire area and interchange, and that included a bypass around Clinch Mountain, which would connect up with State Route 72, and where 71 and 72 intersect on the northeast section of Gate City. That's still a great idea that needs to be done, and along with the possible major improvement of the Moxon Gap area, the interchange that's shown on the right-hand side. So that drawing there has been around for several years. That's not a cheap project, but it's a very needed project. And again, it would provide an alternate facility for getting traffic through the gap if something happened, if you have a derailment or if you have a major accident, you would have a secondary route to move traffic through. Otherwise, again, I'm just repeating, if that happens, you could have a really serious situation with emergency services or just moving traffic in and out of southwest Virginia, even eastern Kentucky. And this is just showing the base of Clinch Mountain. We'll get to a better shot here in a minute where the bypass would come in. And this aerial here does show from the right-hand side, I'm looking at it, to Moxon Gap over to State Route 72, as we call it, the Clinch Mountain Bypass. This is needed. So, a couple more projects, State Route 224.
Go back to that, Mr. Secretary.
Yes,
that
sir.
Slide we're looking at, yes.
Mm-hmm.
How far down do you have to go to get around if you don't have that bypass? How much time are you cutting off?
You've got to go down to, I think it's, I forgot the name of the street, the Gate City High School.
How?
You get about a mile.
Mile down.
Maybe a mile.
Then come back to that road.
About a mile, mile and a half. Got to go and work your way through the campus of Gate City High School, over past some businesses, back over to 71, and then work your way back to 72. It's not, particularly during school rush hour, it's terrible. You can't get through there.
Don't listen to them.
Did they hear about this yesterday?
We said we had to wait through three stoplights.
It was only two.
Just ignore all three of them, huh?
Yeah.
Traffic's traffic.
Traffic's traffic. That's right. It's all relative, I guess. But this, this has been in the works for many, many years, and this will be a two-lane facility. This is not a interstate design level. It's just to move traffic around the east side of Gate City.
All right, thank you.
224, Tennessee, four-laned State Route 93, which leads to 224 many years ago. And we thought Virginia was going to do the same. They didn't. They did make some improvements. But I think this needs to be finished out as to four-lane 224, or at least widen it, maybe three lanes. That works sometimes to match the Tennessee capacity, I guess you'd call it, over to, again, to Moxon Gap. A study was done last year. Got the consulting firm, but they did a study of both 23 and to State Route 224. In other words, all the traffic, all the corridors moving from Tennessee into Scott County and reverse, and came up with some proposals that I already mentioned about 23 and also widening 224 as well, which is, again, the alternate to 23. State Route 71 out to 72, we mentioned that a minute ago, needs to be improved. Part of it is three lanes. You can see that on the left. It just needs, that three lanes needs to be finished out to 72. And from the photos on the right, that's about not even a mile to finish that out, to make that link, make that improvement. Carter's Valley Road, you've probably never heard of Carter's Valley Road. I'm not even sure what the state route is. That is another east-west route that connects State Route 224 with US 23, and it's really the only route short of Moxon Gap that you can get over to 224 and back. It is it's a pitiful road, to be honest with you. You can see on the left, it has no shoulders. It's geometrically a nightmare, and it needs to have some improvements. I would expect treatment on Yuma Road be like what you're going to do for Yuma Road, or did I say East Carter's Valley on to Yuma? So. And this map, rough map here, shows that location of Carter's Valley Road. It actually goes into Tennessee slightly over the U.S. or State Route 36. Again, safety improvements, it's clear zone, sight distance, bridge repair, all very important, particularly the shoulder and sight distance. We're pushing that really hard in Tennessee. We've got some roads that we've had some accident problems, some crash problems, based on the fact that there's no shoulder, there's no clear zones, and that needs to be addressed. So that's, to me, really, really important. I know that's not a capital issue, more of a maintenance issue, but I think it's very, very important. And there's a systems management with signalization. This is a map from our long-range plan that shows traffic signals and zones. We have a closed-loop system in Kingsport. I think in Weber City you have some timing. You could probably use a closed-loop system over there if you don't have it. To improve the progression of traffic to particularly Moxon Gap. Freight component of our plan, let's do that again. We've done a lot of statistics on Scott County of freight moving in and out. Because of Kingsport's industrial base, there is a lot of coal, there's a lot of freight traffic that actually moves through 23, and again, they've got to fight their way through Weber City, which I think is needs to be corrected for the movement of trucks. Transit. Virginia has a rural system. Tennessee has a rural and an urban system. I see lack of coordination between these. I think you need to talk to your transit folks and have them discuss with your rural program in Scott County on better coordination with Tennessee, because we see the MEOC buses and vans all the time in Kingsport, and we have our CATS system. There's no coordination, and it needs. We've talked about it for 10 years, coordination. I think that needs to be discussed with your rail and public transportation people. We have a bikeway master plan, and also we need, we'd like to get more involved with Scott County folks on that new initiative as well. Plan your work your plan. That's what we all need to do. So I thank you very much, and I appreciate you bearing with me. So, any questions?
Are there any questions? I ask you, Delegate Kilgore has raised with me a couple times about one of these projects on 23. Which is the one that could potentially have the best impact on movement on 23 here in Gate City, Weber City?
Probably 224. It's probably the 224 widening project. That is the alternate. As you can see on the map here, it's a rough map, but you can see 224 to the east, where the area is to the right-hand side. That's your alternate route into Moxon Gap. and that is two lane. There's some geometry problems and some bridge problems, and he's probably talking about improving that, which would take some of the pressure off of 23, quite a bit off of 23. It leads into State Route 93 in Tennessee, which is a four-lane facility that goes out to Interstate 26. That's probably what he's talking about.
And how much is, do you have any idea what that project is?
No. Donnie, you know what the price tag on?
We currently have safety projects that we, or safety projects we've applied for is $10.2 million.
But that's safety? And what about
that is safety. That would be shoulders, guardrail, and straightening curves where we've had several accidents.
But I thought you were talking about widening it. Is that possible?
That's an alternative. I mean, you know, that's expensive. What's about $40 million, something like that? To do the whole thing around $40 million, you got to...
More focus is on the Route 23 Boxing Gap Interchange, 224. Currently, in this current the study that was done, we can handle a two-lane facility for the near future.
Okay.
Mr. Secretary.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Mr. Albright, I just want to thank you for your comment about better coordination between Mountain Empire and Tennessee Transit.
Yes, we need that.
You know, we are in the midst of new transit funding, which will be tied to performance metrics, so we'll certainly follow
okay,
up.
Okay, thank you.
Looks like a way for better service and better...
Definitely need that. Need that.
Thank you.
Okay,
any other questions?
Yes. The primary concern of Elgin-Kilgore is 23, and as I refer to it, Wadlow Gap.
Yes.
10.3 or 10.5 million improvements.
Okay.
And what is it? That's which one?
23.
23 and. Water gap is 224.
I didn't know the number, but that's it.
How many miles is that?
Man, I'm not sure. I think about four, maybe.
About 10 million miles.
And then, how about the widening? If you did the $40 million project, that same 4 miles.
Yeah. Like I said, Tennessee did their widening. It's four lanes. As soon as you hit the state line, it's four lanes on 93 there. You can see that. So it just needs to match up.
Great. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Lawson. Sort of not good news.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary and members of the board. I'm going to, given the... fullness of the agenda today, try to hit this one very quick, and if anyone has any particular questions, I'd be glad to answer them. Just from a very high-level perspective in terms of our monthly finances, state revenue collections are just slightly behind the forecasted growth of 2.8%. Motor vehicle sales continue to be strong, and as we've seen all year, motor fuels tax collections are running a little slow. But unless there's any objection, I'm just going to skip right on to the end and kind of point out that, as you see, our state tax revenues are just slightly behind forecasted growth. Spending across our programs is right on track with what we were forecasting in terms of anticipated spending at this point through the year. Construction expenditures have really been strong this year. We've got about 20% growth over last year, and that is really due to the activity on the PBTA projects that we closed on last year. And again, I'm pleased to see that the maintenance program is operating on target this year, and we should be have an end of the year balance this year well under $100 million and probably looking for something in more in the $25 million range.
So
all right.
We will be done with these enormous balances.
Yes, sir.
Could you explain any idea why? I mean, we've obviously always been talking a lot about this issue on the gas tax, but it dropped dramatically, the revenues in January. Do you have any idea why?
At this point, I can only attribute it to the price of fuel. as the price went up pretty high during the month. At this point, I have not gotten any additional data from tax, though, to help explain what the rationale was in particular. But again, you're looking at month over month, I mean year over year, so it's sometimes hard to compare just the change in a one-month activity.
But the thing is that we're still over the last 8 months, still running below.
Correct.
Last year. Yes, Ms. Delaney?
Ms. Lawson, I know we have about $2 billion worth of cash on hand, of which I got a two-part question. About $1 billion of that or so, looks like, or a little bit over that, is in bonds waiting to be used on projects. So, first part of the question is, did we meet our cash? We're looking to reduce our cash balances for money that's stored for maintenance and construction. Did we meet those goals?
Yes, sir. If you notice on the cash chart, you can see the Highway Maintenance Operating Fund, you know, is only showing a balance of about $170 million.
Right.
And that
was our target.
And that is that gets us down into basically in the target range we're after. And you can see the construction has a balance of about $160 million. So they're really your two operating funds that we have, and they have been brought down into what we would see as a very managed range of cash.
Second part, besides, do we get any benefits from holding those bonds, I mean, overall in the state, or is it just related to the project? I mean, we have all those balances sitting over there. Is there any benefit for us?
I'm not sure I'm following your question.
From a cash management perspective, I know they're restricted funds, but, I mean, does it give us any opportunities? Because, obviously, we're paying interest on them.
Yes, and I'll speak to this a little more later. But one of the things that we are looking to do, obviously the Garvey proceeds are dedicated to some very specific projects. We may have some opportunity with the CPR bond program, though, to be able to use it to help accelerate some of the additional revenues that are now coming into the program.
So you get a benefit of paying this interest.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Mr. Gold and Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lawson, a little finer detail, if I could. On the highway maintenance and operating cash balance.
Yes, sir.
Our expectation or objective was 75 to 100 million balance.
As in a year-end unspent allocation balance,
right.
Correct.
So we've decreased that to or by 37 million so far this fiscal year, right? Is that what this is saying?
Oops.
We've got roughly another 80 to 90 million to decrease. Are there particular dynamics that will drive, because you are saying we're going to meet that objective?
Yeah, I mean, what's going I think I understood your question as to how we're going to bring that balance down. If you look at, you know, spending to date, you know, we are about 15 million ahead of what we had expected. Looking at an end of the year balance of about 27 million. So in terms of just the way the spending is intended to play out for the rest of the year, that's how we're looking to finish this out.
Mr. Chairman. Can you speak to the priority transportation line? Give me a little detail on that. Under the trust fund?
Yeah, that's the PTF. That's the Priority Transportation Fund. That fund, most of the monies in that fund are held for debt service on the CPR bonds.
Okay, so that's sort of like revolving fund money in the sense that we're not looking to spend it per se. We're not looking to spend it down per se.
Correct.
We necessary operating balance.
That program, that fund collects cash, most of it in the first half of the year, and then we make the debt service payments twice a year.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? CPR sales.
As we mentioned just a little moment ago, we do have the CPR bond program that is used to support many of the projects that were in the six-year program. Just a little history, and the CPR program was approved in the 2007 General Assembly, and it was a $3 billion authorization with the intent of the direction of the funds to be used for 20% for transit capital, 4.3% for rail capital, and then the balance were to be used to provide federal matching funds as needed to enhance the revenue sharing program and to support statewide and regional projects. The program was set up for a maximum annual sales of bonds of $300 million, and any unspent or unsold amounts could be carried over to the following year. The authorization was increased in 2009 by $180 million, and that was done to support some general funds that had been pledged to the transportation that were then taken back. As an acceleration effort for the program a couple of years ago, in 2011, the governor's transportation bill made it possible to accelerate the sales and to be able to do three sales of $600 million over 3 years for $1.8 billion in total. To date, we've done four sales, and you can see that illustrated here. The first sale was in May of 2010. We have done two $600 million sales, one in May and 11 and 12, and I'm coming to you today to talk about a planned sale in June of this year for another $600 million for the final 1.8. Just a little bit about how the bonds have been used. They have been allocated and outlined in the six-year program for both VDOT and DRPT since 2008, and you can see here just the amounts following those percentages I talked about earlier is how the proceeds are to be used. Just from a very high-level perspective, you can see here just kind of how some of the funds from each of the sales were dedicated, and really, you know, as you mentioned earlier, we do have some significant bond cash today in hand, but we are looking to see how we can utilize those proceeds and this sale to be able to accelerate potentially some of the projects they were already planning to use the bonds for, or potentially to accelerate other projects with bonds, and then be able to backfill with the revenues from the new bill. Just as a kind of information for you, the debt service on the CPR bonds are provided for by the Priority Transportation Fund. The largest component of the revenue is the tax on the on insurance premiums, and as I mentioned, those do come in. We the way this is dedicated in the law, the PTF receives the first insurance premium taxes in the year, so it gets all the revenues on the front end. It gets $20 million a year from the current fuel tax, which is changed as with the House Bill 2313 to get 4% of the sales and use tax on motor fuel. And it also receives some interest earnings on its own funds. The code requires that we have a minimum 1x annual debt service coverage for planning purposes, and for bond issuance purposes, we keep a 1.15x coverage to ensure we get a rating. Based on that 1.15x coverage ratio and the revenues that we're now expecting from House Bill 2313, what you see here is the series of sales made through 12 and then projected through 2020 that would consume the full $3.18 billion. What we are now recommending is a sale in the beginning of June of the final $600 million. Not asking for action today. We'll be looking to come back next month as an action item for your approval. With your approval in April, I would carry this to the Treasury Board for their approval in May, follow up with the rating agencies. We would be looking to do a competitive sale early in June and it would be closed before the end of the fiscal year. Any questions?
Mr. Call.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lawson, understanding the DSC ratio is by code is 1.0, is the 1.15 a bond covenant?
Yes.
It is a covenant. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
No.
John, what do you expect the bonds to price at?
At this point, we're expecting the TIC to be probably something in the 3.75 range.
And the last 600 was at what?
It was. I don't have that
lower,
right.
Wasn't it? It
probably was a little lower, and I can get it to you in just a few moments. I've got it. I just don't have it in front of me at the moment.
So is it just a matter of CTB action that we say use these on earlier? Is that what you're basically telling us, the cash balances? That was really just my question earlier.
The discussion we had earlier would feed into the program development.
Okay, program. So no, I got you.
Mr. Secretary?
Karsinski.
Yeah, John, I'd like to take it that this is really the last year of the acceleration of funds through the bonds, and that starting in 2014, we go back to reality a little bit as opposed to that great window we had provided by the governor to put the pavement down and rail down and bike paths down.
Right. This is the third of that accelerated sales level.
Okay,
all right.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. There's no issue. We have this within the debt model for the state right now.
The sale is in the...
Great.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Generally, we have any idea where the market... It's still pretty low, right? The interest rates?
Yeah, probably around 3.5, 3.25, 3.75.
Excellent. Any other questions? Okay. Mr. Lawson, I think you're up again.
All right.
Presentation you've all been waiting for.
Show me the money.
Show you the money. Okay. Last month I gave you an overview of the preliminary fiscal year 14 through 19 financial plan. That plan was based on the revenues as we knew it at the time, and as you recall, wasn't particularly optimistic. What I have for you today is I wanted to give you an update based on the enrolled version of House Bill 2313. As you know, as well or better than I, the lack of transportation funding has been a significant issue for quite some time. You know, it's been a generation since there's been a significant adjustment to the transportation revenues. We continue to see the value of our current revenues decline, and we still are uncertain as to where the federal transportation program will carry us. You know, since 2002, we've used state construction funds to support the maintenance operation. Some $3 billion have been diverted over the last 10, 12 years to further address maintenance needs. We also started using federal funds to support maintenance activities starting in 2006. In this current fiscal year, 2013, the state crossover is $364 million, and we're also using $330 million of federal funds for maintenance activities.
What was the year in which it was estimated we wouldn't be able to match federal
crossover?
17, yeah, before we brought into play soft match, yeah, we were looking at about 17 running out of cash to be able to handle crossover match. And as a result of this, we haven't had any funding through the construction formula since 2009. The updated financial plan based on the House Bill 2313 does include about $4 billion of additional statewide revenues over the 6 years. The 14 through 19 preliminary six-year plan totals just nearly $30 billion. And this does not include about $3 billion of local and regional funds that would go to the localities or the regions and not in, and are not included in the CTF revenues.
Just Northern Virginia and Tidewater
Growth. Well, you've got a component of the marketplace equity that, and I'll get to more early, later, that would goes to all localities, and then you've got the specific components for Hampton Roads in Northern Virginia. This is just the chart that shows the by major revenue source the revenues that are anticipated over the 6 years, totaling $2.9 billion. You can see the revenues from the bond proceeds have been basically restored since we now have the additional revenues in the PTF to support the bond program. This chart, it may be more valuable to you. It actually shows you the comparison of the prior six-year program financial plan versus the February six-year plan versus the update that I'm presenting to you today, where you can see almost $4 million or just over $4 million increase in total revenues. Speaking a little bit about House Bill 2313, and I'll go through this pretty quick because I imagine most of you are pretty familiar with the bill. But as you know, it does away with the 17.5 cent per gallon tax on fuel. And in place of it, it puts on a 3.5% sales tax on gasoline and a 6% sales tax on diesel. The bill incrementally increases the motor vehicle sales tax from the current 3% to 4.3% by year 2017. $100 fee is added to alternative fuel vehicles as an annual registration fee. And in recognizing the transportation, the importance of transportation as a core function of government, that there are some additional revenues from traditionally general fund revenue sources dedicated. The current 5% of the retail sales tax is increased annually up to 6.75%, 0.675% by year 2017. And it's an increase in the retail sales and use tax from 5% to 5.3%. This chart shows you the magnitude of the revenues generated by the bill. These are revenues provided from Department of Taxation, with the exception of fiscal year 19. And what we have done for fiscal year 19 on taxes direction is to base growth in 19 off, it's the same as 17 to 18. So when you look at the 6 years, you've got just over $4 billion of new revenue associated with House Bill 13 for statewide purposes. This is the statewide component, correct.
I thought I read somewhere where the 2014 number was expected to go down and then recover, that there would be less than was projected. But this chart showing that's not the case. Is that correct?
That is correct. There is an increase in 14. I think if you look at it in pieces, looking at the chart, if you notice the first kind of orange line,
right,
which shows you the difference in just the fuel tax.
Now, the way I read it, it was an overall reduction, not a large one, but
a couple different variations of the bill.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah. So there were two variations that actually showed a dip in the first year. And it's basically because it would have been revenue neutral in the first year, and then the sales tax.
The original bill.
Would continually increase.
Thank you.
Mr. Lane.
So we lose $1 billion of that depending on congressional action with the Marketplace Equity Act if they don't take action.
That's if I may, what I wanted to point out on this chart, if you look at the bottom, you don't see marketplace equity on here in terms of revenue. What we have done on this forecast is made the assumption that marketplace equity is not in play. So you see that the third line, it shows the I guess I'll call it the backstop that's in the bill. You see the increase from the 1.6% increase on gas. And then you notice the next to the bottom line, we have held the sales tax diversion at the 15 level, which is both of the triggers or the impacts of the bill if marketplace equity doesn't take place.
Yes, Ms. Miller.
What is the incremental difference between the component, the backstopping component, and the projected marketplace equity act component?
Thank you for that segue. This slide shows you just that. The top part component, half of the slide shows the revenue as we have forecasted it on the previous slide without marketplace equity. The bottom half shows what marketplace equity, the difference would be if marketplace equity were approved before July of 13 and everything would go into place. So you got $380 million over the 6 years.
Yes, Mr. Lawson. The diesel sales and use tax going at 6%, does that mean that the road use tax through IFTA will increase from the current 21 cents, or will it stay at 21?
No, all of that is, and I don't have the details right in front of me, but it's all adjusted. It is all adjusted.
21 was always higher than...
Correct.
So it will not be. It'll be equivalent to the 6%. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Thank you.
The gas tax being computed as an X amount
of plus
the IFTA,
so maybe about 21.
Okay.
Sterling?
Earlier you mentioned the way that revenues would be allocated in some by regions and localities. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the NEA, the Marketplace Equity Act. If it's not put in place by Congress, and instead the other trigger goes into place, does that go by region and locality, or is that done by state? How's that work out?
This chart, yes. I think this chart does a good job of explaining where the monies go. You see here, what this chart is doing is saying, based on the revenue source, where would the revenues be distributed to? And you notice the bottom line, marketplace equity, you see where those go. So if you don't get that distribution, what you end up with is the extra monies are in the top line. Just some of the benefits of the revenues from the bill, I wanted to point out.
I just want to make sure I understand that. So if the Marketplace Equity Act doesn't go in, then all the monies go to transportation?
Statewide.
But if it goes in, looks like 40-some percent would go to, 24% to education and 18% to local. So is the true $379 million really the difference for transportation, or is it less than that? Because 24% would go to education.
What this is showing is just the transportation component. Correct. And that's the reason for the sales, that incremental diversion from stopping, is because you don't have the MEA revenues going toward education. So that was the reason for that as part of the stop.
So to be clear, the $400 million or the $380 million of incremental increase is all the transportation components.
That is the statewide transportation component.
The 24 and the 8, when you say local on that chart, what does that mean? The 18% local.
That is a local option, and I'll get to it more in just a couple slides.
Okay.
In terms of use of the funds, I want to point out that the bill will direct a portion of the retail and sale, the additional increase in retail sales and use to mass transit and to intercity passenger rail. I think we've been looking for a long time for some dedicated revenues for intercity passenger rail, and this will provide, as you can see, about just over $300 million over the 6 years, and about $470 million for mass transit. In terms of the maintenance program, I just wanted to kind of remind you of this was the picture from a month ago. We had about $4.5 billion of support from crossover and from the federal funds helping out the maintenance program. The new bill will provide about $3 billion in new HMO revenues that will reduce this support. And I'll speak to that, kind of the picture of that in another slide or two. Before I do, though, I just want to give you a quick reminder on construction formulas. We haven't had them and haven't been able to use them since 2009, so I'm not sure how many of you even remember the use of a construction formula. So it hasn't been something happened recently. But last year, the General Assembly approved an alternate formula to be used to kind of help dedicate or direct and more efficiently use revenues, especially in smaller amounts. And what that formula does is distribute 25% of funds up to $500 million. That's up to $500 million a year can be distributed through this formula, I should say. And it's 25% for bridge reconstruction and rehab, 25% for high priority projects, 25% for interstate and primary pavements, 15% for PPTA projects, 5% to unpaved roads carrying more than 200 vehicles a day, and then 5% to smart road technology. Any amounts above the $500 million would then go through the original formula, and that original formula from 1986 has 5.67% going to unpaved roads, and unpaved roads in this category is 50 vehicles a day or greater. And then the balance would go 40% to primary, distributed by construction district, 30% to secondary, distributed to each county, and 30% to urban, which is distributed by city to the city or town.
Mr. Chairman, I was here, even though I was here when we did this, or last had it, can you remind me how the distribution to the localities is done? Is it by population or road miles? Is it by road miles?
Each system is different. Primary is a combination of vehicle miles traveled and lane miles. Secondary is a mix of population and land area, and urban is purely done on population.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Miller.
Lawson, the verbiage in the first bullet says may be distributed as follows, not will be distributed as follows. Who decides may? Us?
That is correct.
So we could distribute $400 million or $300 million or $100 million or zero.
That is correct.
Thank you.
But in that case, if we, let's say we do zero, that means all the funds goes by the old formula.
By the original.
That is correct.
Original formula.
Yeah,
that is correct.
To the allocation.
So we have a choice to make.
Mr. Secretary?
Yeah, although, I mean, the reason that we did this is, as you can see, you got 75% of the money going to 25% going to some what needs to be done on some major rework that has to be done on bridges and interstate pavements, and then trying to focus on jump-starting some of these priority projects.
It gives us more flexibility and options.
Well, the problem is that if you go back to the old formula, as you can see for the first couple of years, you don't have that much money coming in, and we're dibbling out, you know, tens and twenties of millions versus being able to focus on some major substandard bridges and pavements. as we just learned and we'll hear about on the Hampton Roads.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. Sherwell. And also, we have to get ready for the future. If you look at our current program, we'll have to be able to put more money in our design area because we have the types of plans that are ready. So we'll be we'll have design plans ready for the construction phase of the project where the majority of our money will be coming in into the out years. And, you know, so we have to have, and I think this formula, alternate formula, gives us that type of flexibility. If you look at our program, you're going to have to have somewhere around about 10% of your construction program is going to have to be in new starts, in engineering work, design work. Looking at our current program, trying to prepare for this bill and how we put the funds to work, that's one area that we sorely need to invest funds will be in the design area.
Yeah, and I just to add, and go along with this again, it's it is the fact that it's only a 5 years, right? It goes out. This will get the program at least back up and started for what we will hopefully see. You know, the sufficient funds in the future that go back to, you know, a very standardized way of dealing with the projects, which we haven't had because of lack of funds.
Mr. Korzynski.
Yes, Mr. Secretary, thank you. John, is there a, and maybe this is to the commissioner and to the secretary, but on the 25% to the high priorities, I was just talking to court about this from the historical perspective, is there a criteria for establishing that? I mean, we've had all the MPOs come up and say what their priorities are, but how are we establishing our priorities? Is that coming from the administration or a combination with the board, or is there going to be a formula to say, here are the top five priorities for the Commonwealth of Virginia from a transportation standpoint? Is it going to be objective, I guess, is what I'm trying to get to.
Korzynski, during the General Assembly session, the governor issued a project list he was going to recommend to the CTB, looking at some long-needed priority projects that things like the 64 on the peninsula there, rebuilding, the 2866 interchange.
606.
606. I think we have the 95 courthouse. So these are projects that have been around for some time. Will have a major impact on congestion based on criteria that the VDOT had. And so the governor was recommending those to, obviously, what he published was a recommendation that will come to this board and will be, you know, put in the proposed six-year program, but at the end of the day, it is the CTB which will adopt whether those projects are going to move forward or not.
Thank you.
Chairman, the only other comment I would make is that form of these sunsets?
It does, in fiscal 20. And looking forward to implementation, what we are looking to do is to use the CTB formula during the period to distribute the first $500 million available over the 6 years for each of the purposes, or each of those categories. And I'll show the dollars, how they fall out in a moment, but the way the bill or the code is laid out, it says the funds have to be used in these categories, but can be altered based on project cash flows and et cetera. So what we're looking at doing is over the six-year period, making sure that we utilize the funds within each of the categories. As I mentioned earlier, the additional revenues in the PTF will support the CPR bond program as we had originally planned. And I just wanted to point out that the bill also provides for some additional funding for the Route 58 corridor in conjunction with House Bill 1953, which raised the maximum bond authorization on the corridor program from $704 million to $1.3 billion. the bill would provide $20 million a year toward that program beginning in 2020.
Isn't that what the debt service on the existing project for 58?
The current debt service on the 58 program is about $52 million a year.
So what
the intent here is in 2020, the current debt service has fallen off, and with the monies that are the $40 million that's already coming from the recordation taxes, the $20 million would supplement it and support the additional bonds.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Miller,
Lawson, the first bullet where you say funds will be distributed using the new formula, the $500 million in funds. Is that the same?
Yeah, that's the previous.
What's the difference? Well, that's a dumb question. One says may, the other says will.
His assumption is what he used. It will be done.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is one of the items that we brought to the board last.
And I don't. I'm not suggesting I disagree with Will in terms of what we would do. I'm just trying to understand what. Is this your assumption, or is this?
Well, last year we said this is how what we were going to do in last 6 year program.
Right, but each year stands on its own, I believe.
Yeah. But the list that the governor proposed gave to the General Assembly was based on what we adopted last year. And so the projects that the General Assembly is expecting, and that the governor is going to be proposing, is based on the guidance that CTB adopted last year, which was to use the new formula. And so the six-year program is... at least what we're going to be coming to you on is based on the new formula, or the temporary formula.
So it's fair to say that it's expected that the may in the language that will act on that.
I think that's what the chairman's saying.
The General Assembly had that list. The General Assembly are the ones who looked at the list.
All right.
So, I mean, for the first $500 million, again, we're down to what? It's only four more years of this.
Before it sunsets.
Before it sunsets. It gives us the opportunity, because it's one way or another. And I got to tell you, we got some major, I mean, if you just, again, look at where that money's going, between bridge and highway reconstruction, that's more than half the money. It has to go out there. Okay. And we don't have that much money coming in. I mean, as we don't hit that $500 million mark to go over until what year?
17. And I'll have that. Get to that slide in just a moment. A couple slides back, I showed you what the HMO support was expected a month ago. This is the new picture. As you can see, the revenues of the HMO are sufficient to eliminate crossover by 2017. And we have been able to reduce the federal support as well. So this in total, there's a reduction of about $2.7 billion in support to the HMO over the period. The reduction of federal funds into the program is also key in that it makes more state money available to help address the secondary system needs, which wouldn't be federally eligible. This chart shows you the distribution of the new revenues for construction. There's a total of about $2.9 billion available for construction over the 6 years, above what was expected. The first piece of that, $120 million, is from the CPR bonds that we did not think we'd be able to issue during the period. That leaves $2.8 billion that is to be distributed through the formulas. And as discussed, we're looking to use the CTB formula and distribute amounts up to $500 million through it during the 6 years. And as was mentioned, you can see in the first couple years, the amounts are fairly small, extremely small in the first year, and then reach $500 million in 2017. And then beginning in 2017, you can see where excess amounts above 500 would be flowing through the original 40-30-30 formula. I do want to point out that, if you recall, in January, I gave you an update on the funding outlook and the changes in the revenue forecast. And as a result, there was nearly $700 million of deficits in the revenue. So it's kind of the first use of these funds, even though they're in those categories you saw on the previous slide. It really is to fill holes from that $700 million in revenue reductions. Some additional uses of the new revenue, as outlined in the bill, there is an increase or an adjustment, I'll say, to the city on the county maintenance payments. The payment for counties having area greater than 100 square miles is increased from about $9,500 per lane mile to 12.5. That will result in about a $10 million annual increase in the maintenance payment to Henrico. And the payment amount for areas less than 100 square miles was held at the 2013 level of $17,218 per mile. So that holds Arlington constant.
Yes, Mr. Brown.
Because it's specified for fiscal year 2014, what happened in 2015?
The existing language that says that we will grow the maintenance payments to the same growth rate that we apply to the VDOT's maintenance payments go into play. As far as because what it's doing is just re-benchmarking the base point for 14.
Okay. So these will be the new numbers set in future growth.
Correct. And the bill also dedicates $300 million a year to the MWA for Dulles Rail Project. So it's $100 million a year that would go starting with 14, 15, and 16. In terms of the use of the funds, as we talked earlier, a significant portion of the funding was to be is dedicated to pavement rehab. And in the six-year program, as we are working on that draft now, looks like we would have about $3 billion dedicated to reconstruction and rehabilitation of the pavements. And you can see how that plays out in terms of amounts per system. That funding level would improve the interstate system to 82% or above for each district and have no road with a critical condition index, I get that right, below 30 by the year 2017. It would have primary system payments at 82% by 2019 and have secondary system payments to 65% by 2019. And as I mentioned, you know, dedicating the construction funds to interstate and primary, it will allow the maintenance funds to be targeted on secondary road improvements.
Mr. Morley.
At the last board meeting and board meetings before that, there was some concern expressed by the board about our investment in pavement. And so what we were trying to do is to look at what could we do with the funds that were available. So we have the $3 billion represents a combination of maintenance funding over the six-year period as well as the construction funding over the six-year period. And with that $3 billion, we think we can accomplish those areas. Now, this interstate goal is a little different than your interstate goal before. The interstate goal before was 82% on a statewide average would be in good condition. This goal is 82% of all districts. The interstates in all districts will be in good condition. And to identify any roads that are below or any roads that are in poor condition or at the 30 CCI level, that we would be creating a project to fix those roads. For the primary system, we're pretty much at 82%. But the secondary system, it's going to take a major investment. It's almost $1.2 billion over the course of the 6 years to make that improvement to 65%. That's a significant investment there, but we felt that was kind of the sense of the board. So in our planning purposes, which, you know, again, this is subject to change, but our planning was to try to put the proper amount in the paving area to accomplish those objectives. Now, this objective will probably have to be approved by the board if that's what you so desire, but we did change that level a bit from what your previous goal was. So I wanted to bring that to your attention, that this would require your action. This is how we're planning, in our planning phase, is how we would use the funds.
Yes, and there are sufficient funds to do that, because we had goals before we didn't meet. And so, I mean, are you comfortable that these goals can actually be attained?
I am comfortable that these goals can be attained over that 6 year period, yes.
Cool. Commissioner, of the $3 billion that we're talking about here, would you venture a guess as to how much of that is normal maintenance versus catch-up maintenance?
I can guess.
I would say approximately $750 million is going to be major rehabilitation. So I'll answer it that way, if you want to define that as the catch-up. The balance would be pretty much regular maintenance on our roadway, the paving area.
So the balance is something we can expect year after year after year? The
balance is something you could expect year after year, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Further, the additional funds, we'll have funds, as mentioned earlier, to go through the construction formula since the first time since 2009. The $167 million you saw on the slide earlier for the primary system is intended to be largely used to support primary pavement improvements. The funds that are dedicated to the secondary system would go to the Andrew Urban, would go to the cities and counties, respectively, about $125 million between 17 and 19. And as you know, the cities and the counties and towns would actually determine how those funds would be used. It's about $141 million to provide it to address unpaved roads through both to combine between the two different formulas, which should have some allow for some significant improvements to unpaved roads across the Commonwealth. All of this will require some close working with the regional entities to use the funds most beneficially and in combination with the CTB funds. That's certainly something that you and staff will be doing and working with the localities to see how to best use those funds. Obviously, these new revenues are very welcomed and should help move some key projects forward.
Sterling?
Because these two haven't overlapped, at least when it's got to the larger phase, the revenue sharing program, the money in this that goes to localities it's not eligible as local match for revenue sharing, is it?
Actually, it could be used. Cannot be used for that. Okay. This chart shows the spending in major category that you normally see. Again, the bottom being the kind of the comparison chart you saw earlier, where you can see that the key line is the bottom one, construction. It goes from what we was expected to be about $7.4 million a year ago to February's number of about $6.2 million to, based on these preliminary numbers today, about a $9 billion construction program. Turning just briefly to the local revenue component, and I won't spend much time on this. As I mentioned earlier, the marketplace equity component of the bill does provide that of the monies associated with this, that localities would get 1% as they do today of the existing sales and retail sales tax. And of that 1%, half cent would go to, it would be a local option for the locality, and half percent the locality would be required to use for transportation purposes. The bill also generates some revenues specifically for Hampton Roads and Northern Virginia. In Hampton Roads, there's a 7% local sales tax, and they would be given the 2.1% sales tax on fuel that is now already being done in Northern Virginia. Northern Virginia would pick up the 7.7% local sales tax. They also have a regional congestion relief fee, or a grantor's tax, of 25 cents per hundred, and a transit occupancy tax of
3%.
Yes. While
you're on that chart there, the local option tax, the optional part, that is if they want to initiate. It's not something that's an automatic. Is that correct?
No, it's
no,
mandatory. It's not an option.
It's not. It's,
it is mandatory.
It's mandatory.
Okay.
Right. It's existing 1%. But this is.
The state will be collecting it and depositing these into a state account that then they will get money.
This.
That's not like the optional regional tax rate.
That's right. No, this will be actually. This is actually a mandate on those two heavily populated, heavily congested areas, that then the funds will be collected and then will be placed actually in a account kept at the state, and they'll draw money on it.
Sir?
Yes, Ms. Lane.
Is there any language that, I mean, I guess these can be bonded or be used to support revenue streams for major projects, and if it's going to be held at the state, is it a possibility the state would be that entity? Is there any language in any of that?
For the local piece.
The local piece.
Is it? No. I think the MBTA
has that authority.
I'm not sure about the.
Is there a reason we wouldn't want to be able to do that?
Or I'm getting to is, Mr. Nordau, how they can be leveraged and what entity might possibly be able to do that if it can be done.
We did not ask, well, this was not placed in the legislation.
Just trying to be able to respond, Mr. Nordau, to questions.
5 more days.
Okay, and I don't believe the, at least the TPL is even requested.
I thought there was a lot of discussion, that's why I wanted to,
But they, when you were at the TPL, did they didn't even request it, did they?
They're going to begin discussions on how, yes, there was talk.
There's been some discussion.
As to how they could, if it's possible to leverage those funds.
Be a nice option.
Their choice, it's their money.
All right.
I don't know that there's a
funding
ability,
entity, that can do it.
Ability to do it. The TPO is not a. I don't think they can do it.
They can.
Yeah, I think they would.
No, it's a state. I mean, this isn't really, I don't think it's going to be counted as state revenue.
No.
We don't control the money. And the, and obviously the state is not going to issue bonds that would count against its own debt.
Okay, that's the answer to that. So if they got to, if they do it, they've got to come up with an entity.
And legislation would have to come with it.
So I guess the foreseeable future is...
Okay. This slide just shows you kind of the estimated value of those local revenues to Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads. You can see that's about, just averaging at about $300 million a year for Northern Virginia and about $200 million a year for Hampton Roads. In terms of how the monies were used, and the bill is light on the Hampton Roads component, and basically just says that the monies will be deposited into a fund to be solely used for new construction projects within the Hampton Roads region as approved by the Hampton Roads TPO. The NVTA component is a little more prescriptive. It identifies that 30% of the revenues will be distributed on a pro rata basis to the localities within the area, and then 70% would be controlled by the authority to fund projects selected by the area. There's some additional language here about how the authority shall go about giving priority to it. And most of this language here about the authority is actually language that was done previously when the NVTA was created. So it's not new language, but it does provide some structure to the NVTA.
Mr. Chairman? The difference in the way, with the Hampton Roads is very specific in which those are. This one says embraced by the NVTA or the authority. Is that because they want the flexibility for members to come and go? Localities to come and go into that authority? Because that seems to me that people could be added to the authority or be embraced, or communities might decide to opt out.
No, the NVTA is very specific as to who are the member jurisdictions.
Okay, so that who they embrace is already set in stone. You wouldn't see a locality coming out of it.
Yeah, a little bit of the history here. Back in both Hampton Roads and Northern Virginia had authorities established back in 2002 in anticipation of the sales tax referendums in the two jurisdictions, two regions. When that failed, the General Assembly later took away the authority for Hampton Roads, but Northern Virginia, because of the fact that it's a multi-state MPO, used to use the thing called the old Transportation Coordinating Council Commission to coordinate state positions and projects for Northern Virginia. So they left the authority in place, and then the authority, obviously, when 3202 passed, again, there were two authorities. Northern Virginia continued. The Hampton Roads was stood up again, but then it went down. With the TPO, and so the MBTA has actually been in existence for 10 years, and it's very specific as to the jurisdictions, and I think Ms. Garzinski is actually a designated member of it, and so this is why you got this kind of difference, because Northern Virginia have had this authority, it's been in existence for 10 years, and it's very, but the TPO down in Hampton Roads, it's essentially the only body, because it is, although now they've added North Carolina jurisdictions, essentially in a Virginia-centric organization.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Ms. Fisher.
Mr. Lawson, just to clarify, the $300 million approximately that's going to Northern Virginia does not include the $300 million that's specifically targeted towards Dulles Rail, correct? That's separate money?
That is correct. Just summarizing, the new bill, or Health Bill 2313, will provide some much-needed revenue for Virginia's transportation system. It will provide revenues to the HMO that will eliminate the state crossover and provide funding for construction formal allocations. And the new revenues will also mitigate the reductions, revenue reductions that we'd already previously identified, so we don't have to take that $700 million impact that we thought we may have to take. The revenues will allow us to focus on pavement rehabilitation, and we feel that the construction programs will be increased by, again, the size of the construction program by nearly 50%, from about $6 billion to about $9 billion, which will allow for advancing some much-needed projects. As mentioned, there's dedicated revenue to IPROP and to mass transit. There's the regional funds for Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads to help address some of the major needs in those areas. And we've recognized and we've already began discussions with local governments and the MPOs to help build and upon and enhance their partnerships with those areas to help deliver transportation solutions that are most beneficial to everyone. And that's all I have.
Any other questions for Mr. Lawson? Lawson, thank you very much. Okay, General Assembly update. Mr. Walton in the train.
Which one is it? Which one's mine?
Right there.
Okay. To advance it, I do want.
That's how you want to show it.
Yeah, that's. Can I click to advance or? I use this clicker to advance it.
You don't even need it because it's just brought up as a Word document.
Okay, so what I do.
So once you finish with it, just close it out. Then open up another one if you have enough. But you can go through the hyperlinks now.
Okay, there's many pages on this line, so. Okay, well, you all have heard the most important piece of legislation already, Mr. Lawson, so I'll quickly go through other bills that may be of interest to you. I don't know if this, I can work through this, because apparently I have to close out and enter each new page, so I've just got a paper handout. Hopefully you all have a link that you all have an easier time going through it than I will. First couple of pages are agency and governor's bills, House Bill 2040. Deals with our quiet pavement study. We're extending it for 2 years because the jury's still out. We're waiting for some tests that are being run down in Mississippi that are being done with a number of states in a consortium to look at quiet pavement benefits. Funds for access roads, we removed the regulatory requirement and made it guidelines to make it consistent with the board's revenue sharing, economic development access programs, make all those programs you have guidelines rather than regulations. House Bill 2044 eliminates the Recycled Materials and Highway Construction Advisory Committee, which was created in the early 90s. Their purpose has been served, and they haven't met for about 10 years, so we decided to go ahead and just strike that from the code. The next two, House Bill 2105 and House Bill 2106, were two bills to bring the code into compliance with requirements of federal law and federal regulation. House Bill 2116, and I believe Delegate Garrett left, but this was a bill Delegate Garrett carried for us that made a number of changes to the code of changing from the board to the commissioner, a lot of day-to-day management of the department. His favorite one that he used during the session was the board required the map of the Baylor survey. And I have to ask Mr. Lane or Mr. Miller if you guys know what the Baylor, you all know what the Baylor survey is, right?
Well, Mr. Baylor, wasn't it?
Yes, it's oyster beds in Hampton Roads. Another one is the board is supposed to approve every road that a school offers a driver's education course on. So these are just practical day-to-day things the board shouldn't be involved with. The board's a policy board, so we went through and made a number of those changes. House Bill 2186 dealt with the transfer of property to VDOT for our Keene area headquarters. House Bill 2313, Mr. Lawson's already gone through the significant portions of that. In the budget bill, there were a number of amendments to the budget impacting VDOT. One of them deals with the payment to Metro for phase two of the Dulles Metro project, again, making all the funding contingent upon recommendations that have been identified by the U.S. Inspector General being addressed appropriately by MWA and MWA's board. There was also a budget language about the secretary looking into the possibility of the Dulles Greenway being acquired by the Commonwealth, and requires the secretary to report back to the chairman of House Appropriations and Senate Finance by August 1st of this year on that particular project. There's also a provision in that is that establishes a state-funded transportation enhancement program for Virginia assets such as byways. It's supposed to be funded in an amount not less than $500,000 and not more than $2.5 million. And of that amount, it dedicates $500,000 to the Route 15 Journey Through Hallowed Ground program. And then finally, in the budget, there's direction to the Port Authority to work with VDOT and the Department of Rail and Public Transportation at looking at closing the 51 at-grade crossings in the city of Suffolk. You may recall, as part of the Commonwealth Rail Line, we closed a number of crossings in the city of Portsmouth and the city of Chesapeake, but yet there's still these 51 crossings in Suffolk, so the Port Authority is supposed to look into the cost and how to go about to close down those and, I guess, realign the rail line so as to avoid having to use all those public crossings. Regarding the transportation board, other things involving the board, there's a bill that would add the executive director of the Port Authority to the Commonwealth Transportation Board as a non-voting member of this board. And as Mr. Lawson mentioned, there's a bill that increases authorization for debt for the U.S. 58 program. There were a number of bills dealing with naming of bridges or highways, one after former Congressman William Wampler down in southwest Virginia. Delegate Lemunyan had a bill that requires VDOT to post publicly the quantitative ratings that we have of pavements. We'll be starting to do that this year. There was a bill carried by Delegate Greeson and Senator Favola in Northern Virginia dealing with highway crossings by trails. Apparently they've had a number of bicycle accidents up there. I think there's been several deaths, a number of injuries. So this would now give the local authorities the ability to put stop signs on the trails to stop bicyclists and pedestrians from just running out in the middle of the highway. There are two bills associated with hot lanes. One dealing with today, there's a lot of law enforcement that use the HOV lanes for commuting to work, and so they wanted to make sure that in the future that law enforcement would not be able to use the hot lanes for commuting purposes. It would have to be when responding, to something dealing with their official duties in law enforcement. There was also a provision that allows emergency vehicles to go in and out of the hot lanes. Today, if they were in the hot lanes and left or went in, they'd be charged with reckless driving. So this allows them to do that in responding to an emergency.
By the way, you never believe the number of emails I get about this issue on, quote, unquote, law enforcement using the HOV.
I think the number is 17,000 law enforcement employees, because law enforcement and the federal government can be somebody.
Federal Protective Service, Customs.
The Library of Congress, if you work as a security guard at the Library of Congress, you're considered law enforcement.
Everyone seems to have a take-home vehicle, and they all take the HOV lane.
So so once 95 becomes hot, they will not be able to do that.
And actually, it's illegal now for them to use it, technically, right? I mean, they're not supposed to be using it.
No, I mean, today it says, just says law enforcement vehicles can use HOV lanes. So they're using them. I mean, arguably it should be in responding to an emergency or, you know, responding as part of their official duties. And I'm sure that when this new bill goes through, you will have law enforcement that will still say, you know, commuting or doing something as part of their official duties. So I guess that will be a debate between the hot lanes operator and these law enforcement agencies once 95 hot lanes goes online. Again, I won't go through all of these. You have the handout. We had a couple other bills dealing with eminent domain, a couple of the property conveyance bills. I know Mr. Martin, Manel Milling down in your neck of the woods, we're still trying to get that worked out with the property transfer down in Roanoke County between VDOT and Manel Milling. Anyway, if you have any questions regarding any of the particular bills, please give me a call. I'll be happy to answer any other questions anyone has.
Mr. Drake? Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Lane?
Yeah. Yep. So, Mr. Walton, there were no changes to the PPTA Act at all?
Well, no, there was one change to the PPTA Act, and it was Delegate Jones' bill, and Senator Lucas had a bill that was conformed to Delegate Jones' bill, and it really has no impact on VDOT because the changes that were made were changes that VDOT does today. Like one was that you would have to, once you get a proposal, you must keep it out for 120 days for competing proposals. We do that today because Federal Highways has, you know, required us to have at least 120 days. So there were changes to the PPTA, but they are consistent with what our guidelines require us to do today.
Okay, so nothing that would make us any less competitive, Mr. Secretary, in terms of in that regard.
No.
And then, other than the port member probably joined this board, nothing else in terms of makeup of the kind of, in the way we're representing the CTV.
No, I mean, as you know, there were several bills that dealing with the makeup of the CTV that were introduced by folks from Northern Virginia, which failed. I believe it was 51-49 was a vote in the House on that bill. It wouldn't surprise me if the same bill comes back next year, because I believe the people in Hampton Roads and the people in Northern Virginia both believe that there should be additional representation from those areas.
Thank you.
Yes?
One question on Senator May's bill on the Greenway. Does that study just encompass purchase or non-purchase or more optimal use of the Greenway as compared to their unilateral one toll? Did that get discussed?
It's in the budget. So what he had a separate bill, but that bill didn't pass. So it was actually put in the budget. And, I mean, it requires the secretary to study basically the feasibility of taking over the Greenway. And I think Delegate May and several other delegates from that area's intent is to have some value pricing, you know, as part of that, if it is decided that the department should or the board should take over that facility.
Mr. Miller?
I was curious because I heard something a little different when you were talking about the hot lanes, and I think the chairman said something about HOV lanes. We don't have hot lanes other than I would presume we don't have hot lanes anywhere other than in Northern Virginia. So was there any action on HOV lanes and commuting? Same concept.
No,
you get additional value, if you will.
No, I mean in your area there was a bill. Doug Astolli had a bill a couple of years ago that would allow active military in uniform to travel on the HOV lanes, but it required the approval of Federal Highways. Federal Highways would not approve that. Congressman Cantor put a bill in the Congress before last to allow that, and of course it didn't pass, and then when that Congress adjourned, the bill went away. To my knowledge, there was nothing in MAP 21 to address that, and moving forward, I'm not sure if there will be an additional attempt to make that bill happen. Okay, thank you.
No questions. Thank you, Mr. Walton. Director Drake.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, let me get my presentation up. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you for a moment about the DRPT bills from this year. The first one is, which one? Okay. Is House Bill 1858, Delegate Villanueva. This one? What this bill does is codifies a recent Supreme Court decision that rail improvements have a road benefit. What this bill will do is allow DRPT to take title to abandoned rail right-of-way to hold it for future preservation. Next bill, House Bill 2152, Delegate Anderson. What this bill does, it's two things. It ensures that both the Commonwealth and our legislators who serve on transportation district commissions have a vote on that commission. It also ensures that the Commonwealth of Virginia has a proportional vote on the Virginia Railway Express Board. We would have the same vote as the largest contributing local government, with the assumption that we've contributed as much or more than that government that year. Both of these go into effect July 1 of 2014. Senate Bill 1140, Senator Peterson, you've heard a lot about this over the past year. This is our transit performance bill. Our effort was to put transit performance metrics on all transit operating funds. The governor, in his bill, put in funding that would have kept everyone whole, but the result of the bill is the old money from fiscal 13 will stay in the current distribution, but new funding, and certainly there's a lot of new funding this year, you've seen that from John Lawson, will come under performance metrics. There is an advisory committee that's being formed now. DRPT has three representatives on that. We want to thank Mr. Cole for being willing to be one of those three representatives from DRPT. So we expect to have our first meeting April 8th to begin putting these metrics in place so the new funding can be distributed. And then, of course, the transportation funding bill. We are extremely proud of having the $44 million this year for our IPROC fund. We are the only state on the East Coast that has developed a dedicated revenue source to meet this operating need of PREA law. Actually, within PREA, if you don't develop an operating source, you actually can lose your trains. So that's taken place, as well as the increased funding for transit. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Director Kirk? Yes, Mr. Flynn.
Just a comment, Mr. Drake. Now that these presentations are over in terms of the funding bill, I know all the members here with me, fellow members, would just like to thank the Secretary and your efforts. I know you guys worked effortlessly, just tirelessly on working with the governors getting the bill passed. I know it wasn't easy, and I just wanted to pass on our sincere thanks for all your efforts for that leadership.
Thank you.
We got dropped on our heads when we were kids. Thank you, sir.
Sure, how to get it out. Thank you.
The
secret's finally out.
Now we got it. Sure. Is there a little debt back here?
Too far.
And he likes it.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. I'm here today to brief you on the Transportation Alternatives Program. If you'll recall, last fall I came and shared with you we had a number of changes in what you might be more familiar with as a transportation enhancement program as a result of the federal MAP 21 legislation. Just to give you a quick recap of that, the enhancement program as we knew it before MAP 21 no longer exists. We now have a transportation alternatives program that includes the prior transportation enhancement program, Safe Routes to School, and the recreational trails programs. The Rec Trails program is managed by the Department of Conservation and Recreation. Their set aside goes directly to them, and we really don't have any involvement in that program beyond that. And we also had a number of changes in MAP 21 for eligibility. We had a number of prior categories that were popular in Virginia, primarily dealing with historic preservation and scenic and historic easements that are no longer eligible, but we do have 9 eligibility categories. Back in October, we brought you an interim policy for 1 year to look at, give us a chance to figure out MAP 21 and try to refocus what funding we had on existing eligible enhancement projects for fiscal year 14 selections. We've done that. Again, those are the eligible categories. It's primarily focused on bicycle and pedestrian and some historic preservation. We did solicit applications from around the state. They were received in our office by February 1st. We received 51 applications. It requested a little bit over $23 million. This is significantly down from what we typically see, but again, that is because we focused on existing applications or existing projects that remained eligible for funding under the new MAP 21 rules. In terms of what do we expect that we're going to have to allocate, we're anticipating about $18 million. The program, like John presented earlier, we've had significant reductions in our federal funding. That's not we have the same issues with the transportation alternatives programs because it's a set aside. But we do, we've gone back and scrubbed our books. We do think that we can try to keep the program as whole as possible through cleaning up some programmatic allocations from prior years to fund the program at $18 million. If you'll recall, MAP 21 also changed the allocation of that money, and we have some sub-allocations on the basis of population. Half of the money will go to the board members, the district members, and the secretary for statewide selections. That's $9 million, or about $900,000 each. The other half of the money has to be distributed on the basis of population. A portion of that goes to those MPOs that are over 200,000 in population, or what's called a transportation management area by federal regulation. Those areas are getting about $5.4 million, and then the at-large members receive the remainder of the distribution by population. So your packets will look different this year because you're going to receive a list of projects that are eligible based on the population of the locality that's requesting it.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Miller.
So, Mr. Burrell, the MPO piece, I'm interested in the coordination of this. You know, we've got pretty good coordination now because we're all one body, even though the funds are distributed differently. But now we've got the MPOs involved. We can be looking at similar projects on an uncoordinated basis. Do you have any suggestions for implementation that relate to that situation?
Mr. Miller, you raise a very valid point. We have a complex program with the enhancement program because we were dealing with non-traditional projects and in many cases non-traditional project sponsors. And we have grown the complexity exponentially with this population distribution that's in federal law. We're working closely with the MPOs that are making their own selections. They've already received their selection packages. And in some cases, in the case of the Tri-Cities MPO and Mr. Cole's district, they've already given us their selections, and we'll pass that information on to him for his use. We're going to try to coordinate that as best we can, but we do have two MPOs that have elected to solicit for new projects that you won't even see as part of this process. They'll come back in the fall with seeking concurrence from this board of their selection. So
do you have to approve their selection?
To include them in the six-year program and include them in the state transportation improvement program from the federal side, yes, you will take an action on their selections.
So I guess what I'm interested in is some direction from this, from the administration or this body that says, you know, there might be some great value in coordinating with your members, your CTB members, et cetera, regardless of whether, you know, sort of who makes the decision.
We've conveyed that to them, and it's interesting because we see different MPOs taking different approaches as to how they want to coordinate and how they want to select their projects. But they do recognize, particularly with the district members, that they're going to have some overlap. They're going to receive a list of the same projects, and that's one of the reasons why we brought you an interim policy this year, to try to work through some of those issues together before we bring you a more permanent approach later this summer.
Yeah, well, maybe the term is strongly encouraged. At the end of the day,
you know, obviously it's in everybody's best interest, them and ours. And at the end of the day, we've got to take action. And I guess we could choose not to take action if it became a problem. Is that correct?
You could choose.
Or we could take a different action if it was.
You could choose not to take action, or we can go back to them and work through the issues. And I think their selections are due to our office before your selections are due to our office. So that gives us a little bit of time to work through any issues or overlaps or gaps that may come up through the selection process before we bring a tentative list to the board in May. In your packets, and with your selection list, because every project that's in there has received funding through the enhancement program before, we haven't gone through an extensive technical scoring process, but what we have given you is a priority ranking. And the intent of this is to give you an idea of how far along in project development that project is. So when you see your projects, they're going to be ranked in order of priority. A 1 means that it's ready to go to construction. A 6 means that it's just in the initial stages of project development. That's there to give you an indication of how ready that project is to receive more money and how ready it is to get on towards implementation. I also want to give you a brief update on the program status. This was largely why we recommended to the board that we really focus on existing projects this year. We do have a number of projects that are still in the pipeline, but we have completed about over half of the projects that the board's funded in the 20-year history of the enhancement program. The most notable thing to point out in program status is because of the really diligent work of this board in focusing the money on existing projects, projects that are well into development, we've seen the percent of allocated funds that have been expended increase greatly over the last couple of years, almost 3% just since February of 2012. So that focus is certainly something that has really helped us move projects through pipeline. Shifting back to your packet, each of you has also received a summary of all of the projects in your district since the first selections were made in 1993. The purpose is to give you an idea of all the projects that are in the pipeline, what we know of as their current status, when they received an allocation, and it's also going to note for you if any projects that are in that kind of chain to get deallocated where we've sent letters out to the localities asking for status. We do anticipate that we will have more projects that are either complete or have never really been initiated that we'll bring to you in the coming months for you to deallocate those funds as well. Because those are older funds, we can use those funds on projects that are no longer eligible under the TA program. We do have a formal deallocation process. We're constantly reviewing those projects. A copy of that deallocation process is in your folder. Your package on the summary, each of you is going to have a slightly different amount available for allocation in terms of the district members. You have the base of $900,000, but several of you have projects that we have taken through the deallocation process this year, and that will add to the amount available that you have for allocation in the FY14 process.
Before you, with the MAP 21, the new types of criteria eligibility, when you deallocate, let's say this year, is it under the old or the new?
When we deallocate, it's under the old. So the money retains its color at the time of allocation.
Do we have any idea how long that, so it, I mean, have they drawn a bright line as to, let's say forever, if it's pre-fiscal year 2013, well, the Fed is pre-2013, we will always apply the old criteria?
At least for now. It's going to depend on what money we are obligating with Federal Highway. We're always trying to use our older money because it expires. So when we run out of that older obligation, then we're not going to be able to use the old rules anymore. So it's hard to project when that's actually going to happen. So just in summary, in your package, you have a listing of all of the applications. Each of the packages are different, but you have a list of the applications that you have for consideration with the priority scores, a copy of the interim policy, a copy of the deallocation process, the summary sheet that includes the funding available for FY14 based on deallocation. We did also include a listing of projects that we're considering for deallocation, your district summaries, and a staff contact list from my office. I do know that this for some of you, this is the first time we've walked through this process. Others, it's really different this year. So if you have any questions or you want to walk through it, please give me a call. We'll be happy to walk you through that process.
Secretary?
Kwasinski.
Ken, when it says in the chart not eligible for, does that automatically really eliminate that particular application if it's not eligible for the TAP?
That automatically does eliminate that project. For anything that we receive that's questionable, we do get a eligibility determination from the Federal Highway Administration.
Okay, thank you.
In terms of next steps with the program, we've given our packages out to the MPO, the TMA areas. We're giving you your packages today with hopes of completing the tentative selections in April. We'd like to have your selections back by April 12th. Our plan would be to convene the at-large members for their selections as a group in conjunction with the April CTB meeting. So we'll be back in touch with a date and time for that. We do intend to come back to you in May or June with a new project selection policy that we could use going forward for FY15. That will allow us to then start working with localities and the MPOs for the next round of applications, which will start in the fall. We'll bring the FY14 selections to you for final approval in June and then follow up with that policy. And as I mentioned already, we do expect to come back in September, October with MPO selections.
Mr. Secretary, what kind of changes do you anticipate making, and should we think about that when we're making allocations now?
I think our expectation is based on the response we received that we would open the program back up for new applicants. In some areas, and Mr. Lane nodding his head, in Hampton Roads, we only received two applications, which was not what we expected. So we actually have reopened their application process. We're working with the MPO on some additional applications from that area. So we feel like we're in a pretty good place for existing projects, not to say that they would not come back for more money in a subsequent year, but we feel like we're in a good position to reopen the program to new applications that would also include what was previously funded under Safe Routes to School. Okay.
Another question? Roll, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Amen, Leeson, Director Drake.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, this is a rail industrial access application. It's located in Southampton County between Ivor and Wakefield and between the Norfolk Southern Rail and 460. It's an application of $308,000. It's for 2,088 feet of track. Will be 566 rail cars annually. These are products such as it's for receiving and distributing asphalt products, concrete ready mix, that type of materials. The total cost of the rail improvement is $650,000, so the applicant will be doing $342,000. Total cost of the project is $5.6 million with 26 new jobs associated with this project. It is does meet our scoring. It's 70 out of 100 points. We do have an application, of course, from Southampton County, and the rail access was critically important to this particular site. So there is a limit on what we can put in any particular county, and that's what limits us to $308,000 because Southampton's already had a recipient this year. So just shows you the amount. You will also be seeing this as an action item for you today. So happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Okay.
Thank you
very much. Okay. Report on I-64 and 264 in Hampton Road.
more.
Morning, Mr. Secretary and members of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. I'm here to talk about a serious and unacceptable issue of February 8th, 2013. For those of you who aren't familiar, we have members of the board from the Hampton Roads area who have seen it firsthand. But on that day of February 8th, there was a major pothole event in a rainstorm, and our interstates are supposed to be like any other all-weather road, all-weather roads. During that event, portions of former repairs started to come to pieces. The interstate itself did in one location on 264. We got reports on that day and started getting support to folks, but I went down there on the 9th. The commissioner did on the 10th. In addition to 264, we decided to look at 64 as well because as I came into the area, it's not an area I'd worked in the past, coming out of the Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel east, found that I was dodging open holes in the pavement on 64, so we're not going to ignore a problem that we see. So it was every bit as bad and worse than what I had heard the day before. Over 200 claims submitted to TME was our turnkey asset maintenance services contractor there. And as a result of this, the commissioner tasked me to review this and review it to look at our shortfalls, to look at any shortcomings, to look at what broke down, and to see what we can do to get this serious issue fixed. The people on the review team, we got together very quickly. This was done in about 3 weeks. It was myself. We went and grabbed probably our best pavement materials person from the research council, somebody with an awful lot of experience and an awful lot of experience in concrete as well. The other person that we pulled was perhaps our most experienced district maintenance engineer, going on 50 years of experience in the department, has a reputation for keeping his assets in top-notch condition, and those are the kind of people that had the knowledge and the know-how of how it needs to be done, and that's who we brought to do it. Kind of a little background on 64 and 264 itself. The condition of the road, these are roads that were built in the 60s. There had been some rehab done over the year from our interviews. People said anywhere from 10 to 25 years ago. We could not verify that. These things were built at about 9 inches of depth of pavement. And the reason that's important is that was current in the 60s. What they use now, and this depends on soils and other things, is about 13-inch depth. Trucks have gotten heavier. Traffic's gotten heavier. So these things are in a condition that is not pristine. Some of it's been breaking down. And some of the old rehab is actually coming apart faster than the original concrete. Some of the original concrete is holding up pretty well. And so that's just the background. It's not an ideal situation, and people need to know that it's a situation where work needs to be done on it, and it is in various stages of being done. The other thing is that is happening as background is in the late 2007 or so, VDOT had always done 70 or 80% of its interstate work was outsourced, but by code in those days, we went to 100%. One of the ways that staff came up to do that was something called, as the head slide here says, turnkey asset maintenance services contracts. And that's what's taking care of 64 and 264. Those are things like, you can see the bullets, repair potholes, litter pickup, cut grass, but they're supposed to be performance-based contracts. In other words, you don't tell them what to do. They are supposed to keep things in a certain condition, and when you keep it in that condition, you get a monthly payment over the life of it. VDOT is currently exploring other options and is actually doing some internal bids against them and looking at other ways to still keep that 100% mandate to make sure we're keeping up and maybe doing what's in the best interest of the Commonwealth. But that's the situation that's in place. So what we did is we went down and over about a three-week period, we looked at the ground, we got plan sheets out, we looked at what had happened, we interviewed people, and we identified some short and long-term actions that could have, one, prevented what happened on February 8th, and second, identified some recommendations for future avoidance. And the one thing that kind of stuck out on avoiding February 8th, it wasn't one thing that could have avoided it. And, you know, and this, you know, and from VDOT's perspective, you know, we need to look at ourselves squarely. It was probably, you know, one or another one or maybe a combination of things. So there were three or four things that had they been done independently, we would never have been in this situation. This is not a situation that anyone wants to be. This is not where we should be. So what are some of those things? And I've given you a copy of the report, so you can kind of take a look at that in detail if you want. It's a preliminary report. We did the best we could with the information we had, and when you're dealing with interviews and trying to sort out what's happened, the interesting thing was that among the three of us very experienced people, there's pretty good consensus about where we thought this would be, you know, when you take a lot of conflicting information. But here are some of the things that could have been done. When you have an old pavement like that and potentially a deteriorating pavement, the actual patching itself and the quality of that patching becomes extremely important, because that's what breaks concrete down, and the rate of that deterioration is water and the beating it takes and air. And when that isn't sealed, once it starts to break, it isn't sealed as well as it could be. That will accelerate what happens. So that's very important. Some sorts of preventive maintenance that could have happened. Sealing. Our own administration of the contract. We have this contract to do things in a certain way, and I don't know that we kept the expectations the way that we needed to. Matter of fact, I said we didn't. The other thing is we have a maintenance rating program. And we looked at the condition that was out there and what our eyes were showing us, and then we looked at our own maintenance rating program, and one of the first conclusions we came to is our own maintenance rating program isn't supporting the end result that should happen there. The other thing that we can't avoid is that, you know, this could have been avoided also had we been more aggressive in the rehabilitation. We had three contracts underway, a fourth now, and had those been accelerated, maybe had there been some incentive or disincentive, and we've actually since moved some of those forward. Those were happening, but just not fast enough. Some seal and overlay in earlier years with maybe an asphalt overlay or something would have helped. And the other thing that probably not affordable, we're never going to get there, but a major rebuild itself. We're probably going to have to go with a rehabilitation, but that's something that we've got in there. And those are the things that would have stopped it. The other thing that, just to let you know, is we did receive response from the TAMS contractor themselves, and we had sought their input and did not receive it till after the preliminary review, and I've got copies of that, but we're reviewing that right now, and basically, because it disagrees with much of what we said, I mean, to be frank about it, and we need to go through that. We've sought their input, and we will compare that against what we have in our preliminary review. We're trying to find facts here, and we'll take that information from wherever it comes. For the future, what's important for us? I think the first thing, as we've talked about already, and we're doing that, accelerating the rehab contract. One of our first concerns going down there on the 8th was, hey, we're vulnerable. If it rains again in 3 or 4 days, we've got to get work done very quickly to start reducing this vulnerable period on these interstates. So we're working towards that. As time goes on, the less vulnerable we are. But to actually get where we really need to be with overlays and some other things, I think we've talked about some potential long-term contracts. It might take a couple of years, but the most vulnerable period we're quickly getting out of. The more concrete we get replaced down, the better off we are. Putting a task force together to put a long-term contract together for both of these locations, 64 and 264, I think is very important. We've done some similar contracts on 66 in Northern Virginia. We've had similar issues, with concrete that's old and in bad shape. I have never run into a similar situation with the deterioration that we've had, and that's what kind of caught the review team by surprise. That was something that I haven't had personal experience with the other parts of the state. We've been able to get something in place. We've been working with the TAMS contractor and using VDOT crews to get increased levels of repair out there, a lot different types of material and so forth that give us better seal, more substantial, and try to get ahead of this thing. And the other thing, the last year, and I'll kind of leave it to kind of turn to the commissioner, is we're looking for this type of situation where we have degraded pavement, particularly concrete pavement, perhaps looking for some alternative to a performance-based contract. This is something that in the future we just don't know that it's in our best interest, in the Commonwealth's interest, or we can marry up interest with that contract tool to do that, and that's something that we'll offer for the board's consideration. Any questions?
Mr. Worley?
Mr. Chairman. Now, I've gone through the report
by Garrett and his team, and I agree with the recommendations that they have. We are going to implement the recommendations. Some of those recommendations address training statewide. I'm not talking just about in Hampton Roads, but rather statewide training on how we monitor and administer these contracts. We're also going to look at the actual contracts themselves to see if there are ways that we can put different language in the contract that would make it easier to administer and provide more accountability for these contracts. I am going to engage the industry, the TAMS industry, to get their view of what has happened in this situation and how they think that it could be avoided. We are going to look at all of our contracts and all of the roads in the Commonwealth that may be below or in poor condition, somewhat below that 30 CCI we talked about previously. And this review helped me focus on those objectives, on goals that we might want to do as a board, to say that there are no interstate roads should be in that type of condition. And that's how we came up with this goal of having all roads 82% in good condition with no one road below a 30 CCI or in poor condition. That's how we came up with that objective, and we tried to fund that as we started debating and practicing how we could use the new resources that we have and how we came up with a $3 billion commitment over the next 6 years to focus on our interstate primary and secondary roads. But given that you asked at the last meeting that I review the contracting situation, we had a contract or award to TME. TME has withdrawn their bid, and I also recommend that for these types of roads or a road that is in very poor condition, I don't think it would be to the Commonwealth's best interest or the contractor's best interest at this point to do a similar type of contract for a road that's in very poor condition. That would be one of my recommendations to the board, that we get this road under control first, and we repair it, get it in good condition, and then we'll look at what types of best options to maintain the road. So I would ask to recommend to the board that the actual solicitation that TME had won, that we actually cancel that solicitation as well. And VDOT will maintain this part of the road itself, owner-directed. We will hire contractors to perform the maintenance on the road under the direction of VDOT. As you know, as the chief engineer stated, performance-based contract, VDOT does not direct the work. That's up to the contractor. In this case, we will be hiring contractors, and we will direct the work at this point until we get this road under control. Also, we are hopeful, and we would recommend to you that we also do a permanent fix of the road 264-64 from the tunnel to the beach and the 264. That would be my recommendation to the board. We would include that in our six-year program for your consideration. So in summary, TME has withdrawn their bid. I recommend that this solicitation be canceled and that I implement the recommendations that are contained in the report from the chief engineer, and that I will be making recommendations to the Commonwealth, Transportation Board, on a permanent fix of 64 and 264.
Mr. Lane?
Thank you. I am going to recommend in a resolution the commissioner's recommendations. But I'd like to say a couple things. First of all, Mr. Secretary, you mentioned a little while back about the condition of the road, and now we have some monies that can do it. And I'm appreciative of that. That's, I think, an unintended consequence of what happened here. I need to point out there's just no excuse for either the actions of VDOT or the contractor in this matter, I'm also disappointed, quite frankly, that at the January meeting that I didn't immediately say no to this contract. I drove the road. I knew there was something wrong. And yes, we lamented the fact that it was bad, but you know, I'll put myself in that category also. I've spoke to the commissioner. Obviously, he was uninformed about some of the conditions down there, but based on the frankness of this report and how it's been laid out and not tried to hide anything, I have full confidence in your informed decisions and recommendations. So that's why I'm going to make the resolution that we go forward here. But I just want to point out that nobody in this situation did the right thing. And at the end of the day, I know there's going to be contract disputes. Ms. Moore, I appreciate your honesty and laying it out, contract disputes, but to me, that's not what the issue is. Nobody did the right thing. The TME didn't maintain the road, and VDOT didn't make sure they did their job in that regard. I see where VDOT's taking responsibility, and I hope that there are consequences. I know there's going to be training, but quite frankly, if you read this report, there's some individuals in here that need to be held accountable for their actions. I'm not going to tell you what that is. That's up to you, but I don't know that just training is the answer here. I don't know that I would feel comfortable that there would be the same individuals doing the inside work, but I'll leave that up to you. TME, I have not seen anything from them other than saying that it's all our fault in that regard. And if we're truly going to have a partner, I don't think that's the appropriate response from them also. So at the end of the day, like I said, we can all share some of this blame. The right things weren't done. I do appreciate the actions that we're taking forward. I do agree with the recommendation that these things shouldn't be bundled, need more attentive. Mr. Moore, you pointed out this road is a major thoroughfare. It's in poor condition. Can't accept the condition that it's in. But I want to just point out that I do appreciate all the efforts done, and I will be making this recommendation to the board to accept your report, Mr. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman. Any other comments, questions?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to say a couple of things, and most of it's redundant to Mr. Lane's comments, but I'm going to do it anyway. First, I think it's important that we understand as a board that this wasn't sort of a February 8th event. This is about a five-year event or longer. It goes to some underlying issues with funding, but mostly, as Mr. Lane said, it goes to a lot of people not doing their job. I happen to drive this road every day to work. And sometimes I go on 264 and sometimes I go on 64 depending on the traffic, but it's my normal commute. So I do it 5 days a week, day in, week out. There's no question in my mind that the condition of the road and the work that's done to keep it in condition is unacceptable. When we had our meeting earlier that Mr. Lane referred to, and we voted to approve the contract, I agree with Mr. Lane. I should have voted no as well. I did raise the issue. I expressed some concern. I should have been jumping up and down with my hair on fire because that was the condition that we were facing. And I said it before, and I say it again, it's unacceptable. There's no question in my mind that it's a three-part problem. You've got board members from there, and I'll talk only about myself, and I should have taken stronger action. I'm certainly capable of being loud when I want to. There's no question in my mind that VDOT did not provide a proper oversight, and there's no question in my mind that they needed to because the contractor wasn't doing what was necessary. So I'm glad. Functionally, I'm happy that we had the rainstorm. The rainstorm created some action. If we hadn't had the rainstorm, I'm not sure we'd be sitting here talking about it right now. We needed to be talking about it. So I congratulate you all for facing the facts. They're not always pretty, but they're true. They're facts. And I'm glad Mr. Moore and Mr. Commissioner, Mr. Worley and the Secretary, that we're on board and we're going to fix this problem. And I would pledge to my fellow citizens in Hampton Roads, it's going to get fixed and it's going to be done right. So I appreciate your honesty, and I appreciate your work, and I look forward to getting it resolved.
Mr. Cole?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Cole, then Mr. Fisher. Mm-hmm. Mr. Fisher?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Commissioner, how many other TAMS contracts are we engaged with TME in currently?
We have another contract in Richmond, and it's the Richmond South contract, I believe.
And do we have trust issues or concerns in that relationship?
I believe that we're going to have to have meetings with our staff statewide to be much more aggressive in the management of the contracts, the administration of these contracts. That'll be my view at this point. You asked me if I had trust. I just said we need to ensure that this work is getting done in accordance with the contract. And we're going to have to step up our administrative efforts, our oversight efforts.
Thank you.
Was it trust but verify? Ms. Fisher, and then Mr. Woodworth. And
Mr. Moore, as we go forward looking at the TAMS contract or looking at a replacement vehicle for this type of work, do you have a feel for whether the issues are more with the performance standards that are inherent in the contract or the performance of the contractor and the monitoring of that?
I think that the contract is something that with a performance-based contract, it's very, very difficult to administer in some cases.
Were the standards sufficient and they weren't being administered performed properly, or was it that the standards were sufficient and...
I think the standards were sufficient. I think there were some flaws in how they were administered and some of the background around it. And I think as a basic rule, this contract mechanism did not line up the interests of the two contract parties in a way that got the best effect on the road. So a combination of all. Yeah.
That's what we need to read.
If I may add to that, I did say I was going to engage the industry to hear some of their comments regarding this. When I said the industry, there is a particular industry that's come together called Turnkey Asset Management, TAMS industry. I said I would engage them, but what I didn't say is that I am going to conduct a review of the actual contract itself, the terms and conditions in the contract, to make certain that those conditions are the type that we need to make certain we can go follow. So I'm having someone who specializes in performance-based contracts to take a look at it.
I think that's really where we need to decide which direction we go with our future discussion on this.
Mr. Whitworth?
The term performance-based contract sounds good. I'm new on the team here, and I'm not sure I fully understand the flaws in it, other than the fact that we set out conditions to be met, and then we didn't monitor the fact that the conditions were not met. But my question is, is this the type of contract we have throughout our Commonwealth or just in certain areas? And two, is it the type of contract that can be terminated at will by the state, or does it have to be at the end of renegotiations? I'm just not clear as to what are the advantages of this contract that we thought we were getting, this type of contract that evidently we're not.
Let me try to answer the pieces that I can. At one point, virtually every section of interstate in Virginia had this type of contract on it. We have, under the commissioner's guidance, competed internally to VDOT, where now we have three sections that are subcontract, you know, it's all 100% contract, but VDOT manages it rather than a turnkey asset maintenance services contract. So that has happened because VDOT has competed and come in with a lower dollar value to do that. There is a convenience clause. I don't have the answer on any penalties that would that would be involved in doing that. The other thing that is involved is most of these contracts also have the ability to extend them for a year or two if it's successful. So that's another component. I don't know if that answered all sections, but there is a way to convenience to end a contract. They're not everywhere now. They used to be. There are three locations in the Commonwealth that are now being done by VDOT, and with all contracts, contracted subs, and there is the ability to end the contract.
And I just make sure everyone understands that the difference here is that under the TAMS contract, we actually hire a contractor who has some in-house personnel, but for the most part goes out and then oversees subcontractors to do various parts of this work. What the commissioner is recommending and what has been done elsewhere where we've had issues, because we did have an issue, obviously, in the one area with the snow removal, which turned into a fairly major failure, in that instead of having this extra, I'm going to say, general contractor, we're the general contractor. We're still higher. I mean, we're not using we're using in-house personnel just simply for contract administration and oversight.
Simply a contract oversight administration.
Versus having somebody else, a general contractor, who is between us and those subcontractors.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Martin, then Mr. Gorzynski.
Some of you all may recall a few years ago hearing about potholes on 81 down in the Bristol district. And that could have been a situation like this, ended up not being. A few years shortly after that, I think the secretary was just alluding to Salem district, where we didn't know the contractor's shortcoming as far as snowfall handling snow until it actually happened. Turns out that same contractor is quite competent in everything else except handling snow. Now, the things I've talked about might have absolutely nothing to do with this, or they might indeed indicate my feeling is justified that whatever solution we come up with, and I know this is a little oversimplification, so don't think of it as a simplification, think of it as a guiding principle. But whatever solution we come up with must have a spot check, a systematic spot check of the things that can go wrong, the things that are important that we do outside. Whatever system we come up with, have that built in there. Had we known about the snow, had an opportunity to check it to prevent it, we did prevent the similar thing down in Bristol District. Because somebody knew before it happened. And is that something? Make sure the spot check is there and
get
done.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I commend the commissioner and the resolution that Mr. Lane is going to make. A suggestion that I would have would be to prioritize the review of especially the corridors of statewide significance where we affect the most citizens of the Commonwealth. Let's look at those first. I know if we had a situation on I-66 like occurred at 64 and 264, we'd have the same cameras and the same the editorials going as you did down in Hampton Roads. So where the most people travel, let's prioritize those would be my suggestion and start with the corridors.
Mr. Lauterbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. From listening to the discussion, I certainly don't believe there's any problem with having private sector subcontractors doing work, and I'm not sure that we need a general contractor overseeing it because a general contractor is going to add a percentage to that, which is money taken away from our road maintenance and construction. If though we are doing this in-house, it does really require us to be close on in oversight. We have to look at that. We should be doing what a general contractor would be doing anyway, which would be riding the roads, checking it out, seeing how the quality of the work was done, and following up on that. Now, the other question I have is, with these contracts, I would assume, but sometimes you can be wrong by doing that, that we have some penalty for non-performance or improper performance. And that's the thing that I guess we have to be closer on and let them know that there is a penalty for not doing things correctly. I just make that observation.
Mr. Worley?
Mr. Chairman, there are penalties clauses in the contract or where we can assess if the work is not being done properly. And we will be looking at all those opportunities in the contract that would make certain that the Commonwealth is paying for the right service.
Okay. Blaine?
Just one comment to summarize. I think you're hearing my comrades say that basically if you expect a lot, you better inspect a lot. And I guess that's the way to phrase it. But I would like a question about where we stand with dealing with the claims by the motorists who incurred damage and where that stands.
I haven't submitted mine yet.
Mr. Chairman, we have probably over 200 claims have been received by TMA. They are reviewing those claims with their insurance company. We have sent a letter to TME asking for a status of all the claims. The information that we received wasn't detailed enough for me to get a good understanding of where it stood. We have sent another letter, I think it was dated maybe last week, requesting more specific information on each claim. TME has contacted VDOT, the chief engineer, and we are actively working with them now to settle these claims, to settle each one of these claims that have come before them. So that's where we are at this point. VDOT is working, we're actually working together, and TME and the department, to review the claims.
Mr. Chairman.
Miller.
Mr. Commissioner, in a follow-up to Mr. Lane's question, as I indicated in my early remarks, this was not an isolated incident, if you will, or an isolated problem. It wasn't a February 8th event. It was a long event. The 200 claims, are those associated with the February 8th event, or are those over a longer period of time?
I believe the dates, and Garrett, you can correct me, I believe it was from February 7th through, what was it, was it 9th or 10th?
My recommendation to you would be to look beyond that. I don't know what the contractor's record is of paying or not paying, denying claims previous to that, but I would tell you that I think it would be prudent on our part, on the state's part, to look at claims over the period, not just claims from February 7th forward, because there's certainly plenty of opportunity. And in my case, as you know, it was publicized, I've lost 3 tires in 6 months on those stretches of roads, and it had nothing to do with February 7th. It had everything to do with the underlying problem, if you will. So I would encourage you to look beyond that event in terms of how they handled claims and whether they were properly handled.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Schiff and Ms. Fisher.
Mr. Worley, obviously this, you know, there's a weakness in quality assurance in this process, and there have been a couple, and I'll call them anecdotal incidents, although not insignificant dollar-wise incidents in the Richmond district that seem to call into question quality assurance as well. Is there a broader concern that you have about quality assurance that may have been resulting from all of the downsizing that we've seen over the last 5 years, or do you think these are just anecdotal episodes?
The answer to the first question, I do think there's a broader concern. And I do not believe it's related to downsizing. We have monitors established for each one of these contracts. And this is the part that I was talking about, training. We have typically been an organization that directs the work. We do a contract, and if something is not, if we think it's being done wrong, then we'll say that's not the way that you do that. And these performance-based contracts, it seems as though we haven't made the adjustment. Now, this is from looking at the report and talking to people. We haven't made the adjustment of how do you manage this performance-based contract. Just because it says the word performance-based does not mean we can't tell the contractor you're not doing this right and you should be doing it a different way. And let me give an example. If we were not, if the contractor was not patching a pothole correctly, and it was blowing, the patch that they put in was blowing out, well, our guys know that if you go in and you dig that the rubble out of the loose gravel out of that pothole, you get the water out, and you come in with a form of the hot mix asphalt, that they know when you do that, it will last. What was happening on 264, we were not patching it the correct way. And we allowed that to happen. And that's where I want to talk to the staff statewide, say that when we see something that's not right, I don't care if it's a performance-based contract or whether it's a contract that we direct, you know, we expect that the contractor is going to do it right. And that's what I mean by the training. I guess training was a softer word to use.
Yeah.
But this is something that we expect. If we're going to pay for something, we want to get the right service.
And my question was directed to a broader scope, and that is outside of the TAMS contracts. Are there concerns?
Outside of the TAMS contracts, I do not have concerns. And particularly in our construction area, we have inspectors. We have a very rigorous training program for our inspectors. Actually, we have hired about 20 new inspectors, and we are not only putting them through a very rigorous training course, we are pairing them with an experienced inspector for purposes of learning the trade. We are concerned that our inspectors are getting to retirement age. I need to make certain that we have other people coming in with the right types of skills and the experience to carry on a robust inspection program.
Thank you.
Commissioner?
That's a great segue, Mr. Commissioner. I wanted to just make a comment. I agree with what Mr. Lauterbach had said about oversight and inspection. We absolutely have to do our job there. But because we've had a bad experience with one or two TAMS contractors, until we have a thorough review, I don't think we should throw out the whole concept, because in general, unless it's something that only the state can do, we should make use of the private sector as much as possible, as long as they're performing up to our expectations. And so I would like the board to consider that as we go forward in discussing this entire issue.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I don't want my comments to be misinterpreted. I do believe there is a place for performance-based contracts. But you got to have the right contract. You got to have the right oversight to make this contract go, and to make it successful for both parties. Well, actually, all three parties, that's it. The contractor, the Commonwealth, and the public who's traveling on the roads. So what I want to do is make certain that we review these contracts, make certain we have the right language in the contract, the right incentives in the contract, and that we also provide the proper oversight.
Follow up to that. The resolution is just on very deficient. In other words,
I understand.
So we're trying to, throw.
I'm talking about our future discussion as we go over the whole concept.
I just want to highlight a couple of points you made in your presentation. The first is, I want everyone to understand, remember that the TAMS contractors only fill potholes, but we are the ones who are responsible for the actual paving and the reconstruction. substandard pavement. And some things, with, I think one of the challenges we're facing is, you know, VDOT, we've made a lot of steps forward, but it's still an organization that's very stovepipe. We have our maintenance and our construction very much separated. One of the reforms, changes that actually occurred before this was the commissioner made the chief engineer responsible for the districts. And why I think this is important is that at some point that pavement deteriorates to the point that it becomes a construction problem. And right now, but when does that happen? When does it stop being a, you know, a TAMS contractor's problem to the district administrator making a decision, this is what he includes on his paving list, and which is not simple when we're talking about concrete, and especially concrete that's deteriorating. So when does it become a project that goes into the six-year program? This is something that I think this pavement issue, this particular stretch of road is an issue, though, that obviously highlights the problem of breaking down some of these stovepipes. But one thing I've always been very critical about, and the previous chief of maintenance, is about how we do pavement assessments. In that you do your pavement assessments almost, was it in the fall, in the spring, when we've already let the contracts for the following pavements season. So you may detect a problem on a pavement in, let's say, the fall of year one, and it might not get in the budget to be paid until the spring of year three, because in year two we've already let the contract, and unless you got extra money to put on a pavement, it ends up, you know, we skip a cycle. So you can go 18 months to 2 years after we've determined that a pavement is substandard. And these are things you got to compress, use that technology to better manage how and where we go out and repair roads, because you wait 18 months to 2 years, by the time you go out to pave it, now you've actually, you know, added to the problems of potentially reconstruction because of the deterioration that's occurred. Now down here, there's a lot of issues here. There's a lot of issues, and CME and all of our TAMS contractors, it is about project oversight, contract oversight. We have to recognize that we have to provide that oversight, but it's also on the ups and down side of this thing is we have to be able to make sure that we have the surfaces that are, you know, not deteriorating at the point. And we all know that's down there, and we see it in other parts, particularly where we have cement that's been there for a while. Now, what is disturbing to me also is that the fact that a lot of the repairs that were made, that we're seeing, that the concrete that we were repaired it with is deteriorating faster than the original concrete, which raises questions about the standards that we imposed when we went out with those contracts. So I think, obviously, the commissioner has a plan. Staff is on it. I do, though, want to bring us all back to this money issue, because if you don't have the money to go into the very expensive reconstruction of the concrete, then you're going to end up with problems like we're experiencing right now. And they can go out there and try to fill potholes all they want, and we can go out there and try to pick up slabs and replace it. If you don't have the money to go back and do the serious reconstruction that's necessary, particularly in areas with a very unforgiving environment like you do in places like Hampton Roads, with a lot of water, a lot of subsurface water, you'll end up with these problems. So this is why this project has been identified as a priority in the governor's proposed list to the CTB as making sure we're going there and going to reconstruct it. And it's a very expensive proposition, but on the other hand, it's needed. If you do it right, it'll last, you know, it'll give us 20 to 30 years of good road life, and that's what we have to get to.
Yes, sir.
What are you doing here, Mr. Miller?
Nothing. Thank you, sir.
Thank you all very much. Okay, why don't we take a 15-minute break? Grab lunches in there. Grab lunches. We'll start off at 12:15 and go into the action. Thank you very much.